I've been covering really very large patterns very deliberately, and many people ask me a question about being comprehensivist and then being competent, and what I've learned to do in disciplining myself is to, I can plunge in depth for various periods of time. It's something you really need to know about and you really, really go after and let nothing impede you. Having, however, started from as comprehensive a base as possible, I really never lose the fundamental comprehensivity, and I can come back really quite rapidly to many subjects. For instance, there was a period when I really needed to get out the sanitation for dwellings, and I spent 2 years just developing a mass production bathroom. But I really did find a great deal, and just such simple matters that there was only one man in the United States making designing all the toilet bowls at all the different companies. And found that nobody really knew why a toilet bowl was the way it was except this one man. And he'd inherited his art from some English craftsmen. And he was in a little top room in a building in Toledo, Ohio. And Standard Sanitary and Kohler and all of them were getting their information from him. And I found that making the toilet bowl, so the tolerances that can be maintained between forming the original regular ceramics and again your clays, and then before you bake it, one thing, another thing, a lot of weight, things go out around, so you could not have any machinist kind of tolerance at all. If you hold to a quarter of an inch in diameter of an opening, you're doing very, very well. And all this really became very impressive to me, so I decided to really go in pretty, very deeply, and I found no scientist had really ever looked at the plumbing. Just think of what we're really saying here. This is in our day, scientists are not looking at plumbing. They find fault with the plumbing, they call the plumber. But nobody is asking scientists to look at plumbing and say, you're a pure scientist, you mustn't go on this kind of nonsense. And here are all these extraordinary chemistries that are going into the toilet, and very valuable chemistries are getting all pushed together. Nature is taking a lot of trouble to separate them out, and then we deliberately push them together. And when nature does separating out, if you ever get into mining or refining, you find it's quite a job to separate out. You spend a lot of energy separating out. So deliberately let things go back together. It could not be more unintelligent. So I found that right in the very life of the people who are supposedly being educated to do logical things, right under their nose in their everyday life, they were missing things. So this called for a whole lot of attention. And I did, I say, get deeply into, I found that I could produce stainless steel toilet bowls in two halves of stampings and get absolutely fine tolerances. I was able to really find out how many gallons of water we need to flush out the toilet. We found that people are getting rid of a pint of water and using seven gallons to flush it away. All this beautiful, valuable water coming down the hills that we need so badly. It all began to kind of hurt. If you got in there deeply to see how much advantage could be found for humanity if you really got in. So it was very easy to get these fine tolerances of beautiful stainless steel and so forth. And anyway, the big point is that once you understand, you can be a generalist and plunge, you really dare to pay no attention to anything else in science. Because I've been in so many different fields, I've plunged very deeply in many things, whether it's cartography. When I do, there's maybe 6 months, 2 months, maybe 2 years that you're really off there. Then you come back in the big swing again. There are a number of subjects which I have very good records of all these things. And so there are a lot of flies, and I've just been really handling thoughts themselves, and I want to come back now really to artifacts and slides, and particularly to artifacts because I want to review for a minute with you my own grand strategy of how I carry on. When I made up my mind to peel off and commit myself pre-sessionally to the what had been called the side effects, but that is to really how to make ecology, you get on with ecology and play the game that life is trying to play, of making the big show work and not just looking out for yourself. When I did that, risking realizing that there's nobody to mark your paper from there on, there's nobody to pay you, that only nature would support you. If you're that, my theory was if I was doing what nature wanted you to do, I'd find myself being supported, but be absolutely so indirect that you'll never be able to say this is for that. And you must not get scared because it doesn't seem to be supported right now, but it is, you must really keep on. In doing that, I realized I must not waste any time. You're going to have to be terribly sensitive. You have to use everything that you're born with as a child, with intuition and sensitivity, with that, am I really doing the right thing? This is where a child can really get in the forest and gets to some critical point and gets to do things pretty carefully. So you can really be sensitive. So this meant then that I had just my one lifetime to try to get somewhere, if I really have to get a whole lot out of my time. And I said, my experience tells me then that I've listened to a great, great many people talking to a great many people, and one trying to persuade the other that this is the way things are. I made up my mind that people that I listened to were really not listening too much. They sort of wait for their turn to speak and sound off of it. I decided that what I would do, I would discipline myself not to talk to people unless they asked me to talk to them. I've been, in effect, really asked to talk, and so that I'm talking to you because you're here to be talked to, because I'm sure this is the only time really people are listening, when they want to hear what you have to say, and they say so. So that became a basic discipline. I made up my mind then if I was not going to use words, which so many people do use, as my prime approach, what else did I have? And I said, I see that nature is transforming continually, and it would be possible to comprehend the principles that she really is using structurally and mechanically, socially to socially, really feel your chemistry, feel your technology, feel your hydraulics, pneumatics, electromagnetics, your interattractions, your repulsions. If you really feel those things, it would be possible then for you to take, because nature is continually transforming the environment, that you can really participate in the environmental transforming. And the only reason that you're really doing what you're doing is because you feel that you've discovered that this is why we are here. We are here for one another. And in a sense, you've already discovered that older people have very powerfully conditioned reflexes. It's not easy for them to adjust to the new, to take advantage of the new. They tend to hold on to the old. Therefore, I said, my focus is going to be on not just looking out, but primarily on the absolutely youngest life that has no conditioned reflexes, and to try to give that youngest life, provide environments for that youngest life so that within which environment that child would prosper. The one reason why you find me lying down, remembering how I acted when I was a little kid on a bed trying to get off of bed, but at this time, paid a great deal of attention to saying, inasmuch as there really are only a certain number of transformations, motions of union, there really are, I find there are categories and really hierarchies of tools, and no matter how fancy the tools look, there's pounding, there's pushing and scraping off, the horizontal, the pulling, pushing and pullings, things get down to really relatively few things that can be done. I said, I think that child, all the things a child is doing is very experimental, is finding how it can stand up. It is a superb research operation. And when that little child later on begins to tear paper, it isn't because the child is being mischievous. The child needs to know what coheres and doesn't cohere. He has to keep testing things because having been so informed, so insistently informed by gravity about falling, you must know what you can hold on to that won't come apart when you're falling. That's logical, isn't it? Because it's grabbed at the bed and so forth. Instinctively it does that. So it's got to keep testing what holds together. So it's going to you find they don't, they're not, they tear newspaper and they're looking for things that look tougher. They tend to take your best papers. They tend to look at the thing, try pulling apart things that you, people consider very valuable around the house, at linen, so they might finally pull that apart. Finally, find these things do hold. So I said, if you realize what it is they're trying to find out, it'd be very easy to really arrange things in their environment so they find the things that they need to experiment with, and they don't have to try use a lamp cord to find out about tension. They have another kind of a cord, and it'd be much easier to do it. So that the idea then was, how do you develop environments that are favorable for the new life, within which the new life can get all the information it really needs in the most logical way, and it doesn't tend to engender fear, or that when experimenting, doing things they are doing, something going to hit in the head, or that the society is going to say, stop that, and find themselves obnoxious to society. I felt all this could really be done. So my first focus then becomes developing artifacts instead of words, and by artifacts and tools, I would mean a building is a tool, a great ship is a tool. So the artifact may be, I'm not talking about spoons and rulers and rather small devices, but any of the participation in using the principles of nature to take apart and reassociate and so forth. I'm really talking, generalizing this for you very, very much, but the point is that I find that nature already has things in a certain association. She herself dissociates them gradually. She takes her own rock apart, and we could learn then how you take things apart. You find that the very valuable chemistries that temporarily associate this way, that can be disassociated and reassociated in preferred ways. So that's what we do in mining, going around the world, finding there are certain resources, and then deciding where you're going to begin to separate that out. You've got ore, you have local energies available that make it possible to do next steps of grinding or whatever you want to do, or do you have to forward it in ships to get to another place where there are energies and so forth. And many critical decision made of that kind, but by and large, there's a very big, big pattern here. The metals are deposited very unevenly around the whole Earth. In effect, man goes halfway around the world and takes ore out of the ground and starts separating it. And as he goes along, sometimes leaves things behind, he separates and has the residues, and keeps forwarding. And finally gets highly concentrated metals at various centers around the world. And as there's finally a maximum degree to which he separates these metals out from everything else, the chemical elements, then he starts reassociating them in a preferred manner, as alloys. And after that, we get to the point where things get to be made into special parts or special engines and so forth, and we begin to then start assembling again in preferred ways. In other words, nature has come apart ability, she has reassociability, and you're simply participating in that in a big way. So I find that the total operation going halfway around the world to get the right metals, to bring them to certain concentrated places, while concentrating them themselves, separating them out, a lot of sorted, very valuable materials, and you start reassociating the preferred ways, whether it's going to be some kind of an engine or it's going to be some kind of a building, some other kind of tool. And then having gone into this very great complex undertaking, which is going to take months, it's going to take years to get those mines operating, the ships, it's a very big complex taking a lot of time, and I got to then to demonstrate that all the time has been invested by man, all the energy invested by man, are going to be worthwhile having invested that way. So that what I have to do then is to arrange to get what you produced to available to the most people around the world. So in effect, I now I've produced something that's been assembled from all over the world. Now I must arrange to get what I have to all of the world again to make it most available to the most people. This gets to be the optimum big pattern that you're concerned with. I find then that if I do get it to the most people, available to most people, then we can find out very quickly whether was this really worthwhile doing, and how do you improve on it if it's pretty good. And in the end, humanity ought to be gaining advantage. Humanity ought to be gaining advantage of greater health and more time, a little greater longevity, more freedom to undertake more things. We're continually trying to free up humanity from being locally preoccupied as a local machine. to get free of the use of more and more of its head, to look at more and more of the pattern, to be able then to be more and more effective with its mind, understanding principles rather than realizing how much more it can do with the energies that are available in the universe on the ends of levers to do the physical work, that we're really here to do the mental work. So that my total pattern then is halfway around the world inbound, halfway around the world outbound, which sum total is once around the world. There's a whole lot of energies that are involved. And I find that this makes it possible for me to get into a very discrete pattern. Next thing, I can really understand my totality and have a way of judging whether what you're doing is worth the doing. Such patterns I've just spoken to you about really are then highly documentable, what the diary is involved, and make some very good calculations in advance whether this is going to turn out to be worthwhile to humanity. I do not look on these projects in the terms they have about whether people like the looks of what I'm doing for the moment. I'm always concerned with really how it works. And it usually looks all right because I'm concerned with the, I don't know how to get it there, but how do you maintain it? And how do you, in the end, recover it, take it away when that becomes obsolete because you've done something better? So you get that in the recirculation. So I see a total responsibility in design, getting things to people, not trying to sell it to people, but trying to make it available to people. I'm very glad to be doing this program under the Bell Service because one of the examples I use in industrialization, I consider by far the best example operating in the whole history of industrialization is the telephone service. That is, you don't try to sell people telephones. What you do, you're selling service. You're making it possible for people to communicate, and if you make it, the easier you make it to communicate and the more accurately they can communicate, the more people are going to use the service. So it's a very interesting matter. People should think of, you've got to sell things to people in order to get it improved. People want to, they're going to demand a very good product. The telephone company learned that they didn't wait till people say, I don't know whether I can afford a new telephone. They didn't sell the telephone. The people, they sold the people telephones, then they'd had telephone architects, and they'd had Napoleonic and Voodoo and Georgian telephones, and nobody could possibly sell the telephone to anybody else anyway. So the telephone company simply sold the service, and they found that every time they could find a little better way, they could really afford to scrap enormous systems because they could give so much more service, but the number of people using the service go up that fast. And so the telephone has continually been improved. So when I'm thinking about big systems and world systems, I find that this is a very good field to take working examples. I also then spoke about recirculating, using materials. The telephone company, when I was young, we lived just outside Boston. Our telephone number was number 10, so it was early in the experience of telephones. And it was not long, a few years before they began learning, you get more messages over the same cross section of copper wire. First, we just one, and then we began to get more, got up to 28, and then we got, there was a, increase I went up to over 200. The next increase I remember went to over 1,100, then went up into some thousands. By 1930, the chief engineer of the Bell Lab said that at that time the telephone service was being employed by about 10% of humanity. Said they'd be able to increase the telephone service so the whole world would be furnished with telephone service, and that during that time the telephone companies would neither have to mine nor buy another pound of copper. That during that whole time they would be copper sellers, because they found the rate at which they were learning how to get more messages per cross section of copper was so vast that there actually was a gain. There'd be the amount of copper they already had was a copper mine, and it'd be adequate. That has turned out to be the fact. We have now one communication satellite weighing a quarter of a ton, outperforming the transoceanic communications capability and fidelity of 175,000 tons of copper cable, one quarter of a ton. This is the rate which is an enormous step up, doing more with less. And my whole hope of how we were going to get all of humanity at a higher standard of living starts then looking out for the young life. You don't have to quarrel with them, because you give them something that really works, and that child, that's what he's going to use. And his reflex is going to be conditioned to that which works, and that is what's intelligent. He won't have anything else from there on. And so I said, it's a long pull job we're doing. We have to start with children and have to get a whole lot understood before we can get anywhere. Because I found that the time I started what I was doing, people were thinking about architecture and buildings in such a powerfully conditioned reflex. It was just incredible. That when I began in 1929, the first presenting that Maxine House to people, where I developed a machine for living. It really was a machine, and using the most advanced technology we had, and I was able to do it, provide a three ton house that I was outperforming a 200 ton conventional residence. People, you know, they were so taken up with Georgian, and so it's amazing the conditioned reflexes, and how much is really in there, almost on a fear basis, because it goes back to the power structure in the castle. What the strong man has, the man down the street who's hiring your dad, so that's the way he has what he has. The people just, their eyes were just powerfully conditioned this way. So I had, in all the things I talked to you about, I want you to realize that I never allow myself to say what they're going to look like. I'm perfectly confident if you're doing it the right way, it's going to look strange. But in due course, people discover that is the way how things really work, and they begin to like it because they can understand and feel it. As we began to get into space programs, the devices you see going off in space look very strange to people. And they didn't mind about that going off in space, but if it's something you're going to have around their house that you're going to have to live with, they've been very, very sticky about it. Now, I'm saying these things to you. I'm going to get into these strategies and a number of different projects I've gone into. But I want you to have a little feeling of the overall controls. I'm looking then, as always, a world project. I'm looking at the total history. I'm thinking about the total inventory of all the metals of our Earth, being separated out and progressively more easy to get out. And so I began to see that there might come a time when you wouldn't have to mine anything. In fact, this copper is I also spent 2 years in depth in the Phelps Dodge Corporation as assistant director of research at Phelps Dodge, who's the third largest copper company in the world. And I really there that I did also then plunge in doing some bathrooms and several things, and got into new types of automotive brakes using the the steel we use, the steel is a very poor conductor either of heat or electricity. I got into conducting metals like the aluminums and coppers for the breaking. They carried off the heat very much more rapidly. Yeah. They just cut away for break fade and more effective. And then I found you could even have metal to metal. The Japanese had found that she had carbon brushes and copper together. The metal didn't get worn away, and they're using it for electric trolley going along to pick up its current and not getting nowhere. And I found I could get that into a brake. I developed in Phelps Dodge various things that I got in depth there. One was Phelps Dodge was primarily copper, but the gold and silver co-occur with the copper, and they also became very much involved with tin. And America and all the world was going to need a lot of tin in World War I. Tin ores coming from Bolivia. And you get into low-grade tin ores, and there's lots and lots of low-grade tin ore. And there's something very difficult to separate out. And I found that taking the ground powdered ore, I was able to develop a centrifuge. And I had a centrifuge that had to be water-cooled so the metals didn't get to some critical heat where they break up. Because when you get spinning great weights at great velocities, there's enormous tension that come about. So I wanted to introduce a very powerful flame, the blowtorch flame, into the powder, and be able to centrifuge. So I had to design a completely water-cooled apparatus, which just went on. So all the heat was just at the point of contact of this flame with the powder. And I figured that you might like a cream separator really be able to separate the tin out, because it weighs so very much more. And sure enough, it worked. I didn't get that. They didn't get it into production. They were really very scared of the centrifuge, and that they might really kill a lot of people. But I did find it's actually possible then to take low-grade ores and centrifuge just like cream. And this tin was just running out. It was really beautiful. I've been able to get in quite depth in great many directions, and I've become very deeply involved with the metals and know a lot about their histories. And I would go into talking about that in due course. But I had made up my mind that this morning we'd go through some various slides. I'm introducing to you a number of projects, some of them rather short, but I have really good slides of them. I want to take advantage of the fact that we do have something for you to visualize. And for instance, you find me getting into my map, and I was able then to develop a better method of projection and where there's no visible distortion. It was very important to be able to have a world map without any visible distortion. So if you take the Mercator map and use the land as a background for, say, percentage of resources or how many people are in that particular place, if the background is distorted, with Greenland three times as big as Australia on the map, but the actual fact is exactly opposite, then the relative abundance within that particular area is very misinforming. So I needed a world map that I could always, with absolutely no visible distortion, against which I could show percentages of materials and people, whatever I wanted to see. I needed to look at world all the time, so that's what brought me about my world map. And it is the only world map that is approximately distortion-free, both as to relative shape and relative size. So that brought me into a great deal of experience with the world map. Numbers of times I've drafted the whole world, plotted the whole world on paper, that's good for you too. If you go in depth, you get very familiar with the world. I found that there was something worth the finding. And what I found here was employed with the beginning in the space program. when you start then suddenly going into rocketry, and humanity is awed by the prospect and not at all sure how it's going to come out, and you start then experimentally sending enormous rockets in the sky to go great distances, people get to be quite apprehensive about where that's going to land and so forth. And so that I did make a discovery that there was a great circle around our world from America to America that didn't touch any other continent. And this would be a highly specialized kind of item, but you see North America there, and you see Florida where Cape Kennedy is, about here. And that Cape Kennedy, I've got an axis where you leave Cape Kennedy and you just miss South America, and you just miss Africa, and you just miss Australia, and you go over the neck of New Guinea, and you keep on going around, and you come back to Cape Mendocino in California, and then right back to Cape Kennedy. In other words, it was possible to find a range at which you could fire when you're not firing at the United States. I'll go around that once more, and it would be all right if one of you to come up and do something with me. Would you come up, dear? I want you to put your finger, if you sit down on the floor there, and we use this camera here, and put your pencil, put up your pencil somewhere. I'll just sit about there. I'm going to put this Cape Kennedy on there. You keep the pencil steady when you don't, and I'm going to do the turning.
Okay.
I just want to have it so you can see where it's pointing. See, it's just missing South America, just missing the tip of Africa. If I did it right, it wouldn't. Go back again. Just misses the tip of Africa, just misses Australia, and does go over the neck of New Guinea, and then comes right back to Cape Mendocino,
mm-hmm.
and back to Cape Kennedy. Now, I have some slides of that, and it'd be sort of fun just to see it on the slide, because you can see the line itself. It's carefully drawn as a great circle. So it is the shortest way around the world. In relation to that line, I then had an axis of it, because there's always an axis of a great circle. And it's interesting that how many people are south of that line. For instance, South America is south of that line. And Australia is south of the line. And the Antarctic. So it's just Australia, South America. South America has 4% of humanity. Australia has not 1%, and Antarctica is not 1%. So only 4% of humanity are south of that line. Which says 96% are north of that line. Therefore, the pole, the north pole of that line, would be the nearest to the most people. And the north pole of that line is exactly, it's just in it's in Russia, and it is just south of Volgograd, and that's exactly where the Russians send all their rockets from. In other words, they're sending from the place that's nearest to everybody. I don't know whether they've been working on the geography about it, but it is interesting to me that is so. From the kind of work that I do, I often get extraordinary insights in what are the grand strategies of the big ideologies. And I think that I'm now going to come to the next slide. There's the next slide, please. I'm changing my subject now. Going off the map and that world strategy. You're looking at three rods on a tower, and the three rods pierce a vertical circle. and that's made out of a very high alloy aluminum strip. And so there are three hinges in that strip. There's a rivet at the point where the rod, three rods come out through the vertical circular strip. Next picture, please. Now the same strip now has been depressed, and we see the rods still going through the three corners. Next picture, please. Oh, now we're seeing the same circle of rods. Is a spherical triangle, but each of the angles are quite open, about 120. We see the same strip up high, then down in the middle at the equator. This is now a northerly great circle triangle, and the next one it was at the equator. Then it was a southerly hemisphere circle triangle. Other same three pieces were transforming, and they went through condition of 180 degrees at the middle. Now, I want to talk about spherical trigonometry, and we can let that go. You've all been brought up on your geometry with the sums of the angles of the triangle always 180 degrees. And I find people think that's just absolutely fundamental. So I'm going to have you go to the North Pole and take a great circle, which is a meridian. You now remember, when I use the word great circle now, I'm sure you're quite along with me, remember what they are. We take a meridian down to the equator. And at the equator, we'll then go one quarter of a way around the Earth, and then we'll take a meridian back to the North Pole. Now, meridians impinge on the equator at 90 degrees inherently. So if I go around the equator, which is a great circle also, one quarter way around the Earth, I take a meridian back to the North Pole, I leave the equator at 90 degrees. I get back to the North Pole because I've been a quarter way around the world. Here it's 90 degrees of the North Pole, so I've got 90, or 270 degrees. This is a typical spherical triangle, and some of the angles are never 180. That's one reason why then I went through that model. Just there. Is it possible? Look at the spherical triangle, you see. The same spherical triangle in the picture on your screen is now, those are 90 degree corners. Next picture of that. I can't seem to be able to get that series. There are three such triangles in the series. And they should, now, there's the same triangle with the 120 degree corners. It's in the northern hemisphere, and the other one is in the southern hemisphere. And then that one more, the middle one, where there's the equator, because at the equator, they're all 180 degrees. And there's the triangles, the angles can get up to 180. So what we find then is the larger the triangle, spherical triangle, the larger the sum of the angles. As it gets worked towards, I can make just take the equator then, that's 180, we've got the triangle is 180 at each corner. I bring the same three rods in up just a little here, and the angles would be, say, 160 at each corner. Moving it up a little further, they'd be 150 at each corner. And they will finally, as you get the triangles get smaller and smaller, they will approach being 60 degrees at each corner, but they're always going to be a little more. I discovered what you and I have been brought up as a plane triangle as being normal is the most extreme case of the most local, tiny little triangle. That's really very, very important to remember. As we were taught at school, a triangle is an area bound by a closed line of three edges and three angles. A square is an area bound by a closed line of four edges and four angles, all equal, etc. All the geometries that we learned about were areas that were bound by closed lines. That's what the way the rest was going to do. So that all we accredit about a triangle is what you see on one side of the line. There's a little area inside here. Now the fact is, I said you have to draw a triangle on something, because I'm going to be operational, remember. There's no, even if I say an imaginary triangle, I'm going to be imagining one I scratched in the ground. I continually will imagine a special case. I talked to Sonny Alvarez about this a whole lot last night, that while human minds are able to discover the mathematics of the generalized case, and though we're able to use the principle, we always have to use it, as I showed you the other day, objectively, in special case. And even even though we understand the principle, when we're imagining it, and I gave you conceptuality independent of size, we will always, however, make it into some special, when we make it conceptual, we make the dots of something, we make the points out of something, we tend to very quickly associate, we'll make it pink or something like that, in a blue background, and you're distracting it. But you find that the brain has to use special case. Brain is designed for special case. And only mind has it. So the mind can say to the brain, think about conceptual triangle, but the brain will immediately make a special case. These are great nuances of exploration, but they're all coming out of operational procedure, and strictly to. So I say, when I say to a child, draw me a triangle, he said, where? I said, well, you got to draw me a triangle. So he said, no. I said, how about the ground, drawing the ground? So he draws in the ground. I say, you've drawn four triangles. He said, no, I've just drawn one triangle. And I have to prove to him that he's drawn four triangles. So we're in Philadelphia here. And so he's drawing on the ground here, a tiny triangle. I said, when you drew the triangle on there, you divided the surface of the, you did it on the earth. And you divide the surface of the system that you did it on into two areas. You'll agree that if I make a circle around the equator, I divide it in northern and southern hemisphere, don't you? If I make the circle a little further north of the equator, I will now divide the earth into two areas, a large southern and a small northern. If I get a little further north, it's smaller northern and larger southern. So the little boy has drawn a triangle here, and he's divided the whole earth into two areas. And both areas are bound by a closed line of three edges and three angles. So I said, you've drawn a very, very big triangle there, all the rest of the earth here. And its corners, you think you got 60, the corners then are 60 from, they're 300 degrees each. It's a big triangle. He said, I'm not used to a triangle of 300 degrees. I said, because your school made you so special and so absolutely myopic. It's not a suggestion of your environment. But that's really, we've got to really think of the reality. And the point is, you have deliberately done something to our earth. You divide it into two areas. He said, I didn't mean to be the beginner. I said, you thought up to now you were not responsible. Now you are responsible. You're doing that whole work. So he said, well, I could give me two triangles, a very big one and a very little one. Where are the other two? I said, concave and convex are not the same. And he used to prove that with the reflection of light, the diffusing of light on one side and concentrating light on the other. And so there's always there going to be a big concave and a little concave, and a big convex and a little convex. You've got four triangles. They're always going four triangles. I mean, our friend the tetrahedron, the accountability is there. This is a generalization of the tetrahedron as the minimum system in the universe, the minimum structure. And it can appear as that kind of a fourness. They will always be there. There's nothing you can do without us being there. Anyway, so you to say, I can hide away. No, the universe won't let you do this. Just thinking, I said, divides the universe, the outside and the inside. I didn't mean to do that, but you are immediately dividing up the universe. What right have you to divide up the universe? Well, you were given this special catechism in the mind. I said, you can play with total universe. And I said, it's going to be quite exciting to feel those spherical triangles and understand that. Incidentally, if you do any of the mathematics of plane trigonometry are exactly the same as the spherical, just simply because plane triangle is simply an extremely limited case of spherical triangle. So the mathematics of the spherical triangle, really, there is not such thing as plane trigonometry, it's only spherical. And it's dealing with total systems. And the beautiful complementations of total systems. Now, so we say all you have to do is learn the spherical and the plane is included. Either the plane and the spherical is not included. Again, the advantage is starting working for the whole of the particular. Now, something else I was brought up with in that schooling was being taught fractions. And the teacher taught me that I couldn't have on top of the fraction elephants and peas below. You had to have elephants both top and bottom in a fraction. You cannot fractionate dissimilar phenomena. So that all felt fine. That seemed logical. Until we came to trigonometry. And they suddenly began to give you sine and cosine. And so, what are those words? And show it to me. So, I can't really show it to you because it is a ratio between two. It's a ratio between this edge of the triangle and this angle. So a ratio is a fraction. So suddenly they were giving me elephants and peas, and that's the same as logical. One reason trigonometry has been difficult to people is because they insist on trying to equate seemingly dissimilar phenomena. But if we get into spherical trigonometry, in no trouble at all, because we then realize that the edges of the triangle are simply the arc of the central angle of the sphere. So you have central angles and surface angles, all angles. So your fractions are entirely between angles. That comes very simple and nice. You have to feel pretty good. In other words, the way trigonometry is taught, you absolutely automatically cut the kid's feelings right out. You say this is something not like, these are sines and cosines, there's exempt from the elephants and peas. This is when they said mathematics is something abstract. I mean, forget about all those models. These are the disconnects that I talked to you about when I was trying to find how do we get back to the conceptual and to the exact experience so that humanities can understand all the science, and they can. The more you play with what I'm talking about, the more fun you're going to begin to have. And you're going to find it very easy to take ping pong balls and begin to try out great circles on them. And they're nice to write on ping pong balls, and the colored pens write on them nicely. It's very easy to make great circle rulers. So you find what the diameter of the ping pong ball is, and then you get a little, like a napkin ring that's just half of that, but just the radius in depth. And you sit the little ball in it. And then you just draw on the always great circle. So there's a ball of difference. Again, any 2 points and just connect those points in a lovely great circle. You're going to find a great deal of fun to play with great circles and have concentric triangles and see the way in which the angles begin to decrease. The little man and trying to start with a flat earth and squares and cubes, he said, is just great. And just looking at the inside of the triangle, inside of the square, looking what nothing. What we do there is teaching him to be absolutely biased. My side is right. My town is inside the wall. This is incredibly unbalancing to the little child to be exposed to such bias. I hope you feel more and more with me the sense of responsibility to the child, that little child starting out here, and how easy it was to give them misinformation, and how easy it was for parents just loving their kids to pieces to say, well, that rich man got this tutor and he must know it, so to get that tutor, and the tutor tells it his way, and then maybe very ignorant. And I quickly conditioned reflexes to develop about who is authority about what. But the minute you begin to do your own thinking and go back to experiential basis of things, you can't get fooled. And you continually get better information. It's just so exciting, the lovely, clean things. You suddenly, every time you get understanding, you say something you memorize, some of the local thing you memorize. Isolated from other things. And right, the growths used to be always fascinating. I kept cutting them loose and finding, because you always set a globe into a circle. As long as the circle is a lesser circle, it's just always so comfortable, right? So sit on any bowl, any dish, or so on. So you can have your globe. And really get feeling your whole earth. I suggest to all of you that have plenty of globes around and begin to get on seeing things this way. When I developed my first map, it was in the 30s, and Life magazine published it in February 1943. They were a year or so getting ready to do it, and we went through some very interesting experiences. The art editor of Life was a great friend. Matter of fact, I'd been on Time and Life, so I knew everybody there, and it was just after I left Life that they decided they'd like to do my map. The Life magazine didn't want to go into something like that without being sure that this wasn't something that was well known to geographers long ago and just sort of rediscovery. And so they got two great experts. One was Dr. Boggs, who was the geographer of the State Department, chief geographer of the State Department. The other was a man who was the president, the chief cartographer of the American Geographical Society. And they got two mathematicians. All of the experts said to the Life magazine, this is what they call, they said, pure invention. I didn't conform to any of the well-known mathematics, therefore obviously it was some kind of a fudging out. So invention is just sort of fudge. Somehow I tricked everybody. So I have a wonderful patent attorney, he was considered at that time the best in America. It was way back in the 30s. And he said, that's wonderful. We have a great expert testifying as pure invention. Because the chief patent examiner, the United States Patent Office, had ruled in 1900 that it was impossible to patent anything cartographic anymore, that all the mathematics had been exhausted, so that it was taboo and never considered. So I got the first and only patent on a method of projection that had been granted in the United States Patent Office, out of all these experts saying that it's your invention. Isn't this great? But anyway, the Life took heart and decided to publish it anyway, and we published it in color, and it was a great hit. As Life in those big magazines do publish to get out a dummy a little head, they get, if it looks like a good one, the advertisement, they had 18 pages in of color, and you could paste the edges together and put together. So I'll never forget the Sunday when I had to come out. The wall was right on, deep in there. And I went from Washington to New York that Sunday, and all around the streets I saw kids going around with these globes. It was an unprecedented number for them. They went to two million. 2 million. They never had any such issue before. Well, Henry Luce was very excited that they're doing this. And there were two couriers coming from Australia going to Churchill in England, the two very specially, and they were just coming from New York, and Henry Luce was handling all the public relations for England in the United States, so he was very privy. These men came to him on their way to Churchill. And Henry decided he'd like to have my map taken to Churchill. He got the printouts before it actually published. So the couriers did take it. So the couriers understand how to show it to Mr. Churchill. I put the pieces together. And what I did is I put the pieces together with Australia at the center. I could have my... I just moved my map in place here. It is very much the water ocean world as you see it here. But I made Australia actually the center of it. They say, gee, that's the way the world really is, isn't it? I just want to point out that the way things look to the local person, that is the way the world is. And then I showed them the other way it could be and how they ought to put together Mr. Churchill this way, and they did that too. But all being exactly the same pieces, just rearranged. Incidentally, while life was making up their mind about whether they would use my map, I made many, many drawings, and I had them all little cartoons and so forth. And Henry Luce asked me to come to his house in Westchester for the weekend. He had a number of guests. And after dinner, they asked me to explain my map, so I was doing it in the parlor floor, the people sitting around and so forth. Yeah. And Henry was sitting over on one side, and I was explaining many things from the map and grand strategies of different countries and history and so forth, the way the map tended to change with it. And Henry, Bucky, every human being has an exact opposite. That's your poles, you have your antipodes that you've been showing. He said, you're my exact opposite. I said, that's a very much of a compliment. I said, how do you happen to give me such high position? And he said, well, you seem to think there's something going on in this universe. He was an absolute free willist. He was sure that he said anything I want to do, I can do. And you seem to keep introducing large patterns that are super demand. They said I find this very disturbing way of looking at things. But he felt that all the big patterns were purely man-made. I was amazed that the people in powerful position can get to see things that way. He was used to enormous, but what his magazine could really do to people around the world gave him that feeling. Now, I like Henry Luce very much. We were good friends with life, and one of the things that I had said at that occasion before the map was published was that there was a northwest spiraling going on of humanity, some totally, the center of the population moving westward, if you took some total. There had been a time when men drifted east and rafts, but since the sailing business, everybody's really kind of trying to follow the sun. And it's quite easy to show that northwest spiral and how then Europe came into North America, and then go to South America, it's north. And if you go into the map of the United States, you'll notice I have colors. And the color lines, I have the coldest is the blue, and it gets green, yellow, and the red is the warmest. There's a little line here from where you go between yellow and green. In the United States, it goes like that. And you see it here in Asia, where it may be. You see it going right through Europe here. That is the freezing line. That's where the average mean low temperature is 30 degrees. And so north of that line, you might get frozen if you didn't have clothing concerns. If you're starting a naked man, was quite a very formidable line at the outset. I found that line was really, remember, I've shown you pictures of where the people are. There was another one I showed you, the lights of where all the people are. Look around that, all this way the enormous numbers are in here. This is where our population is. Find that people tended to get up as close to cold as they could because the ice was good for preserving things that you freeze to death. And also, the cooler you got, where there was less diseases, less infections. It seemed to be the sort of the health area. And humanity had tended to find that. Incidentally, when you get to mountains, there are rings around it. These are simply the sum total around the world. I didn't make separate rings with my colors going up the mountains. But they do have all those temperature changes, you know. So, one of the things that fascinated me was the censuses of the United States since 1790. It's quite easy then, demographically, mathematically, to show where the center of population is. And the center of population of America has gone, right from the very beginning, was right on that, that's 30 degrees mean low temperature. And so starting up here, very much in Philadelphia, and then goes southward like that, and out and then out in the Indiana, stayed always right along the line. But at the time of the Civil War, the population went just a little north of the freezing line. It had been just below it following it. But Civil War is an amazing moment. This is 1851, production steel. For the first time, man had been doing his primary work really in the fields, and this is the beginning of the industrial where he's able now to have environment controls and he goes indoors. So he's able then to be a little north of that line. So there's a tendency to have the industrialization north of the line as it sort of started with beginnings of being able to get north of the line. Anyway, that is the tendency was still to get a little more northerly, so that I saw that the next population, I could really make predictions where they'd be, and they were working more and more northwest. So I also showed this to Henry Luce, and I said what had been called the British Empire that I've talked to you about as being British Empire, which I also shown you, really wasn't British Empire, but really was the East India Company. That the East India Company with that's the actual enterprise, the people who put their money in it, where East India Company was a limited liability, where the individual risker could not be punished if somebody suing the outfit, and we call that incorporated in America as LTD and limited in the English world, and the East India Company the South was moving west. The speculators began to move west. And I said to Henry Luce that in due course, this British Empire was going to be the economic controls were moving into North America. And I said that the English, whatever is English, that stays as English at all, is going to really move west. So I said they'll move their headquarters over into Canada in due course, because Canada will begin to be strong, and you find this where their investments are going. So he was very being then I said he was being the he was an Anglophile. He was born in China. Went to Yale University. So he was born in China. His old China had that feeling about the English in Hong Kong and so forth, and he. As I said, he was the official public relations propagandist for the British Empire during World War II, and so he was concerned when I said the things were moving. There came a day about 6 months after that map business when he wrote me a note and he said, "Lucky, you're right." He said, "You didn't know this, but from me. This occurred before the map, and he has heard me on these things before, and I made my prediction about the English in Nine Chains of the Moon, published in 1938. And Henry, while I was on Fortune between 38 and 48, this note came from Henry saying, I could be interested to know that the British had just sent their secret archives to Ottawa. And he said, you really are right, but you didn't know the war was coming. And I said, of course I knew the war was coming. But the point is, how it occurs, and why, is irrelevant. All I say is, I'll say to you what is going to occur, but what are the actual critical factors that make it do? They're very happenstance. They're utterly unpredictable. The big thing is predictable. I think it's important for you to have some feelings of some personal experience in my life that is related to conducting myself the way I am, to give you a sense of confidence yourself. Now, this is not a bad time to tell you about how the method of projection works. Just thinking about the well-known kinds, a maqueta is a very simple thing. You have a cylinder of paper around a globe, and the cylinder of paper is tangent to the globe at the equator. And you have a globe, let's say transparent, and there are the outlines of the continents on it. And there are, on the globe, there are the latitudes and longitude lines. And we have it lighted at the exact center of the globe, and so the lines, whether it's the continent or the great circles, make lines on the paper, the shadow lines. So we see that the light coming from the center, that where the cylinder is tangent to the globe, things are very absolutely correct. So the Mercator is exactly correct around the equator. Then, as you get further and further north, the angles get wider and wider, and finally, the cylinder paper, guess where the light at the center, no matter how far, it will never get to the edge of the cylinder, because the axis of the Earth and the cylinder are parallel. So there's a hole in the top that you never will be able to get any shadow projected. So the further north you get with the Mercator, the more and more distorted things are. So all the Mercators are actually fudged at the top. They deliberately pull down the data that they know about and just change the pace. Then we have something called polyconic, and polyconic is what most of the important charting has been done, where you have, instead of a cylinder, you have a cone. And the cone could just touch the Earth at one point. So where it touched would be accurate, and again, if you're away from the, it's inaccurate. But the polyconic, we have a cone of paper that goes into the Earth and comes out of the Earth again. Can you see a sphere where there's a cone coming like this, and it penetrates here, making a lesser circle, and then it comes out into another circle. Can you see that? So where the two circles occur, they both are accurate, and so the intervening space is less distorted. So polyconic has been by far the least distorted of all the methods of projection in the past. Then there's where you have the light at the center, and this is sitting on a piece of paper, have what you call a polar azimuthal. And so you might get a circular mapping very accurate at the point of contact, but gets more and more distorted as you go further and further away. The polar azimuthal are very much so. There are other modifications of what I'm saying. Those are the main classes. Now, common to all of those, wherever the sphere touched the sheet of paper, everything was accurate, and if you went away from the point of contact or line of contact, it increased in error quite rapidly. What I did was to take the globe with a spherical icosahedron, I use the icosahedron because it has the, again, the largest number of identical triangles. Remember that as we get a smaller and smaller triangle, the sum of the angles gets less and less. If I'm going to want to have something out in the flat, then I'd like to get as near to the flat condition as possible. So that there are 20 identical equilateral triangles in our icosahedron, and that's the largest number of absolutely similar forms. You know, then we saw yes, you can divide that into 120 small right triangles. The amount that the sums of the angles of a spherical triangle add up to over 360 degrees is called spherical excess. When the surveyors are surveying, they always watch out for the spherical excess. So I'd like to have the minimum spherical excess. For instance, if I were to use the spherical tetrahedron, its corner angles would be 120 degrees each. So I'd have 120 degrees spherical excess in my triangle. Right? So if I use the spherical octahedron in the next system, I'd have 90, 99, 270 above 180, so I'd have 90 degrees spherical excess. Getting down to the spherical icosahedron, each of the corners is 73 degrees and 26 minutes. So I have when you have the five come together around one, you divide 360 by 5, and you come out 720. It's an equilateral triangle, so 720 goes to 60 each corner, 72 at each corner. A spherical triangle, icosahedron, 72 degrees at each corner. So that when you flatten it into an equilateral triangle, each corner is 60, so that there's only 12 degrees spherical excess at each corner, and a total of 36 degrees for the whole total triangle. In other words, it is the one that has the least spherical excess to start off with. So I said, that's an optimum condition I'm going to have to end it. Beautiful, because it is the excess divided three ways, which is symmetry. So what will happen is that, because I have 20 of those triangles within the three corners each, so there's 60 packages of 12 degrees each around the map that will subside to 60. And that is really an invisible amount, because the total triangle, as it subsides, will simply contract. So it means that everything shrinks symmetrically. So this is the interior of the triangle shrinks a little faster than the edge. The edge is absolutely no change at all. Because where the edge is, it is it's true contact. So I have by far the most, with those 30 edges of 63 degrees, 26 minutes each, you're going to get 30 times 63 degrees, 30 times 60. All this is absolutely true. As I have by far the most great circling, it's absolutely true. To start off with, and I'm going to have symmetrical subsidence locally. And the beautiful thing about it would be that where this contact is triangle itself, that is all true. So all the change is internal rather than external. Now, when you make two circles, one of a circle of radius 1 and a circle of radius 2, you find that you dismiss your error outwardly in the circle of radius 2. The area of circle of radius 2 is three times the area of circle of radius 1. So that if I dismiss my error outwardly, I have three times as much error as if I dismiss it inwardly. So that there's no way you can get better condition on spherical excess than on the icosahedron. Just thinking about conditioned reflexes of human beings, I spoke at Haverford University 2 years before we published the world map, and I had all the pieces with me, and the mathematics department asked me to show my method projection. And I did. And he asked me if I'd come home to tea at his house with him, bring the piece of him in, and he had some children, his children, and he wanted the children to play with my map, see what they would do with it, the piece on the floor. And they began to realize how to put the edges together so it would work. And he said, "Darling, you have the world upside down." And of course, there's no up and down in the universe. And the mathematics department man was showing how ignorant he was. And the children were absolutely comfortable because there isn't any up and down in the world. How you want to look at it. But the kids had this freedom. I want to stress this. It wasn't a matter of the children being ignorant, but that how quickly the reflexes can be misconditioned. And people with a PhD, extraordinary man. Now I'd like to go into watching our time. I think it is time to have a break, and then I'm going to get into some more of the mathematics. That'll end the map for the moment. Are we still on? If we are, I would like to carry on for just a second. There's a couple more things to tell you about that method of projection. I'd like you to feel this with me and construct a little model with me in your mind's eye. I'm going to take a steel band, and it's nice evenly. You call it a ruler, a steel ruler, and you can have inches, whatever you want. A steel band, very nice and flexible one, rather thin, and clearly marked off in these basic increments. And then I'm going to take three such steel bands, and putting a hole in the end of the steel band, and I'm going to put a liner rivet in there that has a stovepipe through it, so it makes sort of a journal. I'm going to put a rod, two rods, through this end of the steel ruler, and rods through the other. These are very powerful, strong rods that don't bend. I'm going to take then the steel these rods are exactly perpendicular to the ends of the steel ruler. I'm going to have them protrude clear through down deeply, and I'm going to take hold of the ends of those rods and bring them together. And you're going to find that it makes the steel band very beautifully, and the rods come to a common center here. So it makes kind of a circular triangle, arc radius. Now I'm going to take three such bands, and I'm going to, where the corner, make a triangle with them, and bring the corners together, then again have a swiveling rivet go through the hole of the corners, and these powerful rods can come through. You've got three rods and three corners, and the thing is standing up with a flat triangle like that, these three legs now. I take hold of the bottom of those legs, which are stiff, and bring them together. As I do so, you saw that any two of them coming together made the single band bend, didn't it? So all three bands have to bend, because the three rods, each one, any pair of them, the ends of any one steel band. So as I pull them together, all three steel bands bend. As I do so, the farthest, any one side of the triangle with the bend rotates away from the opposite angle due to the rods also being brought to a common center, because they come to the center of gravity. So you see that it makes each one of these arcs bend outwardly, and if it's able to do rotating away from each other, we then really get that's what that spherical triangle is that I had. I simply took those rods, the powerful rods, and brought them to a common universal joint. And we're able then, the bands in this case were a delicate, very powerful aluminum, high oil, 73 ST aluminum. So you could go, that really was a sphere showing itself here. And as the rods went northerly and southerly, it kept just embracing the earth. The spherical triangles just opening a little further, closing a little further. I want you to understand then how then you're able to take a band of even module, absolute module, and make it into the spherical. I want you to understand this just to get your own confidence that the edges of the triangles, which are done that way, exactly that way, it would be possible to take a light at the center of the sphere and project a spherical icosahedron. But if you did, to a planet, paper outside, you'd find as it went through the altitude plane, the angles begin to open up, so it's not uniform boundary scale. This is absolutely uniform boundary scale. That's the only projection in history where you don't break open your package. In the Mercator, you're breaking over the top. You always have something open-ended. You have a line or two reference, and the triangle ends. But in this one, the line or two reference is continuous to the triangle, never breaks open, always contains, and brings about the symmetry. I want you to really feel quite confident, comfortable about what goes on here. So this really amounts to it's a really topological transformation and not a shadow graph. So the words projection would have to be a mathematical projection, but not a shadow graph. It's a true projection, all right, but it is mathematical transformation and not a shadow graph. Now I'm ready to break, sir. Again, in the techniques of our medium that we're dealing in the video scope, and I have a great supply of slides that you know. One of the things we learn is that the video frame, picture frame, is just a little smaller than the 35 millimeter slide, so that we have what I usually like to show vertically may have to be shown horizontally. And I'm going to review really quite quickly those great circles that I had, the pumping of the great circle. Instead of being vertical like that coming down, it's going to be horizontal. So let me have the first slide. And in this, I think you'll enjoy it a little more. It's a good idea to get this feeling about spherical trigonometry. You see the triangle up at the top, on mounted out horizontally this time. That's we're dealing about a 72 degree angle up there. Next picture. And there we're down to 120 degree angles. Next picture. Now we're at 180 degree angles. Next picture. Now we're going to the negative spherical trigger, down in the southern hemisphere, down to about 90 degree. You really feel that transformation of how a triangle can rotate this way and change its. So we've had absolutely uniform boundary scale the whole time, and just simply change the angle. The angle is variable. Remember when we were talking about the necklace structure, and I was getting into structures, we found that the struts didn't change, only the angles changed. And I look for what are the varying things. You begin to get a feeling very strongly about angles. In fact, I've discovered that you can describe all designing can be done with just two phenomena, one called angle and the other frequency. I'm going to have an axis of reference. So a relation of axis of reference, as I said, with a vector, I'm going to go off deliberately, start at this angle. I'm going to go off like that. And now, I say it's angled, so I may not go off in a plane. I can say my angle goes this way. The point is, I'm going to go for so many frequencies. For so many frequencies this way, then I change my angle, so many frequencies, so many, now change the angle. So all you do is change the angle and frequency. And then you finally can outline, shape anything you want. I think that may be said, other than you said, I understand angle, right, but you say measurement, you go so far. I use the word frequency for measurement. Now, next picture, please. I'm going to go through more and more of my slides. Here, again, we're showing something horizontal. At the top, you see your three possible structures, the tetrahedron, three triangles around each corner, octahedron, four triangles around each corner, icosahedron, five triangles around each corner. And at the bottom of that array, you'll see a tetrahedron and it's about by my shoulder here. And then it's not really very well done. We have a series of the corners, three triangles coming together, then it goes four triangles coming together, then five, then it goes six, and it's a plane. You can see it's a plane. That's why it can't be part of a system, because it doesn't come back in itself. And then it goes, the next one goes the negative five, the negative four, the negative three. So there's just the same going between northern and southern hemisphere idea. Next picture, please. Now, here if we can sharpen this up all you can to see, I have an array, and I want to look into something on the, what would be the left-hand column, as you're looking at it. Up at the top, there's one ball. And then below it, there'd be two balls. And then there's three balls and four balls. What I'm studying here are relationships between numbers of unique events. And up at the top, one ball doesn't have any communication to communicate to anybody. It takes two balls to have communication or relationship. Like I said, there's no otherness, no me. My awareness really begins with otherness, because it must be some relationship. So if I have two balls, how many private telephones we have to have to talk between this A and B? You need only one private telephone, because it's just A and B. So if two people have one telephone, I'm going to have three people. So there's A, B, and C. I'm going to have a telephone AB, AC, and BC. I'm going to have three telephones. Any two people must have an absolute private wire. So now I'm going to have four people, A, B, C, and D. I'm going to have, and what you're looking at up on the left-hand column there are the telephone wires between little points. And between A, B, and C, A, B, C, D, I'm going to have A, B, A, C, A, D. That's three of them. Then I have to have B, C, and B, D. That's five. Then I have to have C, D. That takes six. Four people have to have six private wires. This is our friend tetrahedron, which has to have six edges. The four require six connectors. So, in fact, you find this gets to be a sort of fundamental model that way. You find then there are two columns I have up there. One is then the actual number of telephone wires you have, and then we put up the number, because the first case we found we needed none, and we start with one between two, three require three, four required six, and five required. Now I'll tell you n to the second power minus n over 2, because you find it, you actually learn the equation, n to the second power minus n over 2. So I have 5, n is 5, so n to the second power is 25 minus 5 is 20, so divide by 2 is 10, you can't find that 10. So the numbers are going like 1, 3, 6, 10. Now the next one would be 6, so 6 to the second power is 36 minus 6 is 30, divided by 2 is 15. It would be nice if we could have the chart really...
Because it can't get much clearer than it is, and you could probably see it better if it was drawn.
Oh.
But do it your way.
You're going to introduce this later then, or what?
If you wanted to just draw it, the connections on the board, you could...
I see. I think you're getting it in your own perfect theory. So I have a series of columns. If I could go back to the drawing itself. The first one is all the people in the telephone wires. Then the next is a summary of how many telephones are needed. It's a vertical line of columns. Now I find that those numbers, 1, 3, 6, 10, 15, are actually the total number of balls in a triangular collection. Just add one ball, then three balls. Then you get six balls in the next triangular collection. One, two, three. Remember, one, two, three, four, five, six. Set, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. The next one is 15. So we find that the numbers of relationships are triangular numbers, of course. I guess it would be very interesting. Then you find that those triangular numbers are fascinating because if I take three balls, for instance, and I sit them on the, what the next is, six. 3 plus 6 equals 9. Or if I took the 6 and had it sit on the 10, I get 16. If I took the 10 and put it on the 15, I get 25. What do you get? 9, 16, 25. These are second powers. Are there any two sets make what we call the second power? I don't use the word square anymore, you notice. I always say second power, third power, fourth power, I never get caught with saying squaring and cubing. So we find then that here's a triangle sitting on top. The triangle always one ball less. Sitting on top of one, and it makes a second power number. You'll find that you take that top one and hinge it over, and lays it over, it makes a diamond. And when you look at that as a diamond, may have the picture itself back here, because we have these pictures of the diamond then. You'll see they're stacked up there, and then we get into the diamonds where a diamond simply is a square, but remember, these nests at 60-degree angles, instead of 90. So it's a diamond. And you can count up them. You can understand it's a second power to see how the second half completes how the six completes the 10. Now, then we find that if I stack these layers, two layers together, and then I get tetrahedron, vertically. So I find that you and I need a private telephone, or any two of us want that private telephone, I have that in there. I could also then call those the relationships between our experiences. Your child have an experience and have another experience. So what's the relationship to it? If you understand, you begin to understand the relationship between the experiences. So then I find that if I stack all my relationship or all my experiences together, in the end comes out a tetrahedron of such and such a frequency. Otherwise, the numbers of the telephone were triangular numbers, and the sums of all, and of which is these numbers of telephones then is the numbers of experience I've had in my life. These are all the relationships between all the experiences I've had in my life. But these are all the understandings I have of all the experiences I've had in my life. It's understanding the relationship with those points. That's what those triangular numbers are, the understandings of a relationship. So then those are individual experiences. Now, I keep integrating this set of understandings with a new one. I've just had a new experience. So the final tetrahedral stack up there is a sum of all the relationships between all the experiences you have. Really understand being a comprehensivist in the way I carry on with you is very much relating then to all those relationships. So I'm really carrying on in a very tetrahedral manner, as far as it comes out in this elegant, beautiful tetrahedron. Just one more, whatever it is, always comes out a whole rational tetrahedral form, or a whole triangular form. I find this very exciting. What I call this then the underlying bodiliness in superficial disorder, where the experiences seem to you and I very disorderly and random, but suddenly find the whole underlying whole thing absolute order. You can't become disorderly. It becomes really very exciting about it. Now, how's the next picture then? I told you earlier about the two general dynamics scientists who were making experiment with titanium sheet. They make experiments with titanium relative to re-entry problems in the rocketry. Remember that? I had two hemispheres, one half an inch less in radius than the other, and that they were concentrically arranged, and then they were actually sealed up, welded up at the bottom, and so there's a space between each one of them, a half inch. And then they clamped it into a frame, and this is what you're looking at in the picture, and the atmosphere is able to come in underneath the frame into the inside the dome. So the atmospheric pressure pushes the inner dome outwardly like that, as it has very normally. But you exhaust, then the exhaust through the vacuum pump they have between the two, so the atmosphere operating in the outside one pushes it in towards the other one, and it dimples in, I spoke about dimpling, it dimples in the exact icosahedral. This happens to be it turns into be a four frequency geodesic tensegrity structure. In other words, I had also been giving you the way the molecules of gases operate and so forth, and this is the, I'd say they always, they want to get the most economical, which means always a great circle. So they insist not on lesser circles, they get wrapped beautifully into the whole great circles. And when two great circles, remember, close to this, but three great circles, triangle. And now there's all this triangulation in there, and an enormous amount of action, so they average out an equilateral. They keep trying to get absolute equilateral. So the whole thing just makes itself get orderly. Time and again, I get so excited and find how beautiful life is really carrying on, how the universe, under all this thing going on around us, there is this lovely order. Next picture. It's fun to see what's going to come up here. Now, we see three lines crossing one another. Now, one of the great differences between myself and the mathematicians is that all the mathematicians assume you can have a plurality of lines go through the same point at the same time. If you get in geometry where they get into the non-Euclidean geometry, get hyperbolic, you assume still plurality of lines going to the same point at the same time. This is exactly what physics finds can't happen. But I said a line has to be in action. They have the lines going to the same point at the same time as a point. And I simply say to you that the lines, then, if one could go through it, then another. If you have a machine gun, a bullet coming like that, you'd have another machine gun and synchronize them. So one went through, then the other. And it might look like a couple of lines crossing, but they're not. So they have the next, hold the picture a minute. I want you to notice then how those three lines are really crossing. And what they do, they have to be, one has to be superposed to another. So they just automatically do what's going on here. May I have the next picture, please? And this next picture, you see what the physicist is doing. The difference between them, between the mathematician and the physicist is that you find that when two events, because a line is an event, there's just no question about it. You can't have it, I just imagine, I proved that to you yesterday. So we have an event, and there's already an action taking place. Therefore, that's what we call an interference. And with an interference, it could be a glancing blow, and be what you call then a refraction. Just still ticking here, and it changes angle though. That brings about refraction of light, just that. There can be a very tight blow like that. I have the picture back and again, we get then a bounce off. Then there could be another one where they go in first through, and then there's fourth one where we have a smash-up. Now, these are all the things that go on in the cloud chamber when the physicist is bombarding, sending a neutron or whatever. Maybe you can certainly see these bouncings around. And they are all to do then refracting, reflecting, refracting, reflecting, smashing, or the one-fourth one half, where they're going almost the same direction, they get what they call critical proximity, and they get one of those mass attractions, they become one. If the angles of convergence are close enough, then you really can see that mass attraction taking over and then pull over. We had a very interesting experience in the Navy in World War One. I told you I was in a transport service where we took these 130 men over. Basically, with the German submarines and enormous houses, they tried running at night without lights. Of course, they didn't want any lights because the submarine watched for and laying off there, watching, silhouetting against those lights and so forth. Lights are anathema. They didn't want to light. So these enormous groups of ships are going together, and they had to want to stay together. And yet you had the enormous danger of following the other man at night. It was a torturous kind of a game. On one occasion, two of the big transports found, just in avoiding in trouble, one at the end of one got overlapping the other, like that's pretty close. There were two big ships, the Agamemnon, Mount Vernon, and the George Washington, both big ships up in the 30,000 or 40,000 tons, big. And they got where, being in the water and being big ships, their mass was enough so they began to attract one another. That's when you get big ships at sea, they really begin to show that mass attraction. You don't see two apples sitting on the table. The pull of gravity is so great, the friction of the apple on the table, they don't try to go towards each other. But these two ships are free at sea, and acceleration, and they're finally being pulled together. And if they'd ever gotten, oh, the seas were heavy, they would just chewed each other up and lost. I think involved on that particular case, there were some, they'd have lost about 20,000 human beings. The captains of these two ships tried to see what they could do, because they mass attraction, if you try to get too fast, the bow would come over and so forth. They tried to figure out how to, one could accelerate a little faster than the other, and they made troubles. They finally found all they could possibly do was to open up an angle between them and to keep them apart. The idea that they finally could pull apart to get out of that critical proximity to the second power business. They finally did, but they were actually a whole day pulling apart. So when I spoke about lines coming together, one that you can have then light reflection, one you could reflection, well, real bounce off. You could have a smash up, or you could have angle of convergence, be so delicate, you have critical proximity and a possible fall-in. Those are all the things that happen in the cloud chamber. This is all the physicist deals in. And this is exactly where the mathematician completely lost. He's lost all the privilege of thinking, because he said the lines are going through the same point at the same time. This is typical, again, of what these false assumptions that superficially said it's obvious. They said two lines go through a point. Anybody see that? Two chalk lines on the blackboard. But in actual fact, if I do it on the board, chalk or whatever it may be, look at it here, and you really see it literally cross exactly like two, let's go in the snow, and you have this tie go this way. The next one, the top one, is quite clearly is absolutely separate, it always is. So, being completely experiential, completely operational, these are kind of very exciting informations we get. So now we're playing a geometry where we don't get deceived. This is very, very important. We're dealing with all those, because there's a vectors always. My geometry is vectorial. I was thinking then to explaining to you a little about my grand strategy when I was young, saying I don't think that nature has a department of physics, mathematics, I said that to biology, and has to have department head meetings to know what to do when a leaf drops in water. I said I think she has only one department. I would like, if I can, to find what it is, because the chemistry of it says it's very simple. It says H2O. That's where it associates, and it's very beautiful long numbers. So if I'm going to do my geometry, and I didn't like, as I said, the tall, the geometry where the teacher said this is a ghost cube and it didn't have any longevity, it didn't have any heat, it didn't have any weight. I want to get those qualities in. Now, I'm not the first one to want to do that. The scientists going really back to Babylon are trying very hard to do that when they chose the 60 minutes and 60 seconds as a fraction, hoping they'd be able to correlate it with the circle and so forth, with trigonometry. And we have then the scientists having XYZ coordinates, and then they needed to have those qualities of mass. So they couldn't find really anything. So they're very arbitrarily getting into the centimeter. It's nice. It is okay in relation to decimal system, if decimal system is what nature is using. But the arbitrary thing is decimal because we got five fingers in each hand. So the insistence is going to be decimal. So we have the centimeter, one cubic centimeter, and it is really a cubic centimeter with water, they said. Now we have this, what we call a gram. And we know what the weight of that water is then the basis of our weight in relation to volume. We want to have weight and volume coming together. Then they found that the water changes volume with temperature. And thought of that, that became very upsetting. So finally, had to have at 4 degrees centigrade, it is a temperature there, and then it fills one cubic centimeter. That gave you then the official gram. So we have, I spoke about dealing in weight, lifting a given weight against gravity, a given distance, of lifting 1 gram, 1 centimeter in 1 second. CGS, this is centimeter, gram, second. And in relation to X, Y, Z coordination, these became the buildings. But there was no time, even then they didn't have time in there. So the longevity didn't say how old the water was. There was nothing in there to really identify time. So I became interested, and I said, nature does have a time, so I find that you're just so old, and I'm so old, and et cetera. That is a time dimension. I'd like to have that in there. So here's the way my own strategy began. You might as well just know, because this goes really way, way back. So in physics, mathematics, and in my preparatory school for Harvard, I became very interested in, for instance, in the fact that Avogadro, I like vectors. I said if I use the vector is an experience and does represent an event, and it does represent the amount of physical universe as mass is going in a given direction at a given velocity. Because velocity then has time in it. So this is very satisfying. So I got both frequency and time, all these things are actually in there. And those kind of vectorialize are beautiful. They don't go to infinity. Again, the mathematicians keep telling me about infinity. I remember when a teacher said, this line goes on to infinity, and I said, have you ever been there? She said, how do you know it goes to infinity then? So I said, where's the other end go to? She said, infinity. I said, which way is infinity then? And so she couldn't tell me which way infinity was. And I didn't like this infinity very much. So I'd like something, because I personally also never experienced infinity, and I'd like to have something along my experience. So I like vectors because they're absolutely discrete length of line. They don't have inherent extension. It's just exactly what you see there. But I wonder if I can't get up a geometry out of vectors. Because that would have then the time quality, and it would have the velocity, and the velocity and mass impact can be converted to heat, so it has all the elements of experience are in it. So if I could only get a geometry of vectors, that would be great. Then came the moment in my learning about science, learning about Avogadro. And Avogadro had a very extraordinary intuitive awareness. I spoke to you earlier about the human beings and the five lights in the sky and coming interested in it. I also spoke to you about Priestley making his experiment with fire under bell jar, and how Lavoisier identified, he said, why the products of the fire added up to more than the weight of the things he put in, was because something else had joined and came out of the nothingness, which was the air. Out of this, they then got, for the first time, we got elements were gases. And this is so terribly important as to really open up the thermodynamics and everything. It's not surprising that the next five elements we discovered are all gases, and it's because we have the enormous competition that's going to run the ocean world. So the French are putting up money for their scientists, and the king of France and the king of Spain, everybody's putting up money for the scientists. And so they have Rossi is French, incidentally, one of the most extraordinary things that society ever did that was blind and short-sighted was the French Revolution that cut off the Rossi's head. Of all the heads to cut off, I can't think of a worse one. Choice. Anyway, he's so excited. He introduced them, this gas business, and was realized it was the very essence of understanding really the steam. Therefore, English, who did want all the great pirates at headquarters in England, very good, so they're putting up money. So Cavendish, the next 5 chemical elements out are all gases, all Cavendish. Now we have enormous preoccupation with these gases, and Boyle and others, and amongst them, the Italian scientist, Avogadro. And Avogadro, very astutely looking at all, comprehensively, not to being too specialized, looking at the total idea of total gases, as his patrons came and said, I want you to catch up with these boys, we better have better steamship than these other boys, whatever it is. Avogadro then said, it looks as though, and he hypothesized, that all gases under identical pressure and heat would disclose the same number of molecules per given volume. Boy, I said, this is something. He then went on to prove it. Suddenly we have then volume and number for a plurality of gases, which are elements. Now, you know how to place where elements, which are elements because they are unique, were coming together volumetrically and number-wise, which is very much better than just putting water into a cube. Nice. So I said, it could be because elements go through their liquid, their gaseous, and their crystalline states. There seem to be that kind of intertransformability. And the only reason certain things are crystalline and not present is that it's relative conditions of this part of the universe. There have to be this set of heats. If they were in the sun, they're going to be incandescent. They may be plasmic. So I see then, because the elements can go through liquid, gaseous, then we might think about all the elements under some identical condition. So instead of just saying under identical conditions of heat or pressure, that's what he had said about the molecules of gas. I said, it could be, you could generalize that, and I said, all elements under identical energy conditions, which means either heat or pressure, any of them, under identical energy, might disclose the same number of something per given volume. I don't know which one is going to show up. I thought that should be more or less the nature of a generalization. So I said, if then I want to have a geometry made of vectors and all the energy conditions are the same, all the vectors will be the same. That's wonderful. So I said, means all of them are not on the same length, but they all be converging the same kind of angles. I said, can you make a model where all the vectors are the same length and all converging, and also, but they have to take care of the actions, reactions, and results, so there must be angles, joining angles at both ends of the lines. Can I get a system where all the vectors are in a closed system, all the same length, and all the angles are the same? Now that turned out to be exactly what you're looking at up here. Again, a very fortunate thing happened in my life. Often what seemed to be misfortune turns out to be fortune. I find that life is highly compensatory because I was very, very short-sighted when I was born. And so short-sighted that, so very long, far-sighted that I can't, when my eyes advance off, I see exactly now what I saw when I was 4 years of age. The correction has not been changed at all in all those years. And this is my 76th year of these lenses. I see absolute blur of faces. I cannot see human eyes. I can actually make out some darkness where eyes are. And I can see more or less a shadow of nose. I can see the two sort of dark colors. It's purely color matter. Nothing matter with my spectrum of color. So there's a pinkness. This side of your face is a little lighter than that side of your face. And I get really just a little shadowiness that are the eyes. It's like Marina Lorenzian kind of a painting. And there is a little bit more of a pinkness in here, and not I could make out little color differentials. So I did see a human eye until I was 4 years of age, 4.5 years of age, and I got my glasses. Now, because of that, I tended to try to get my... I didn't know, how a little child, what I see is not what everybody else sees. So I assumed everybody's seeing the same way. But my problem of understanding was really quite a different one from the people who could see the details. And I had a sister, 3 years older than I was, and she was always continually telling me the things she could see. And I thought she was making it up, so I didn't want... Every child has imagination, so I thought it's just... I've read fairy stories, I invent what I could see, and I could see some very extraordinary things. And she, I would always get laughs, and my sister didn't seem to get any laughs for her description of what she could see. So you imagine what happened when I was suddenly 4 years of age, and I saw that she hadn't been telling me stories at all. And I suddenly saw hairs. Now, I spoke that there's a compensation here. I went to kindergarten then before I got my glasses. And in the kindergarten, the teacher had some dried peas, semi-dried peas, and she had toothpicks. And she told us to make structures, to stick the end of the pea in here, and the toothpick in the pea. And we found they joined the toothpick so that make structure. All the other kids who could see, the minute they were told to make a structure, immediately tried to imitate houses. The first thing they thought of. So they were all rectilinear. Now what I did, because I couldn't see at all, I wanted to feel something, it feels good, so that a square, those forms didn't feel right, but when I got to a triangle, it felt great. So I felt I could really feel that as nice and stable. So now, I made literally a structure like that. And I remember the teacher calling another teachers from the other school there to come over and look at it, and they were all very surprised at why I made this strange thing. But purely a consequence of my not being able to see, but I was not trying to imitate something. I really said make structure, and I got to the felt right. You can understand that, somebody going around groping the way. It's a purely matter of feeling. And anybody working in clay would just have that kind of feeling, whether it's going to tip over or not, it's cohering. Anyway, I did do that. So it was something deep in me also about that. So when we have the moment of my being saved by Avogadro, he seemed to be giving me some universal condition, and I wanted to use vectors, and I felt this thing. I said, I think I can make that. So I made this. This is called in mathematics an isotropic vector matrix. Isotropic, everywhere the same. Isotropic vector matrix. So I found I could make an isotropic vector matrix. That was just great. But then the isotropic vector matrix turned out to be simply spheres in close attacking. Remember, the me and the other and this, and then we suddenly come together here, and then suddenly we roll around on each other. These little balls are really great, the styrofoam wants to play to get the feeling of that rolling around. From where I am, the fact that I'm rolling, you don't really notice that. The profile stays just the same. And so then I get the three of them rolling together, and I get the one on top nesting in it, the fourth. And there's your six vectors, and so... Spheres in closest packing, all the same radius, unit radius spheres, closest packing, they simply automatically come out the isotropic vector matrix. Now, we were interested in atoms and how the atoms behave and the volumes of numbers per volume and all those things. It seemed every kind of way this is a very satisfactory matter. It was at that point that I also then said, I'd like to see about a nucleus. That's what brought me then into finding then the 12, 6 around one and a plane and 3 on top and 3 on the bottom, giving the vector equilibrium. We got a lot of these balls, and I really would like you to do some experiments with them yourself, because I don't want to slow picture down too much here. And you're all getting pretty well versed here. Now, I've also given you tetrahedron, and I've also given you some the idea of Euler's topology. The vertex is, and the numbers of the edges are not the same as the vertex. Remember that for every vertex, we're going to have three edges and two faces. That's an absolute relative constant abundance of those universe, in addition to the two polarity two-ness, which has to be taken care of. And that is what was not recognized by the topologists. They didn't realize there was a hierarchy. They never understood there was this hierarchy. I'm fine. I completed my own discovery to come then, where a tetrahedron was unity, which you can see how absolutely logical it was. It was a minimum triangulated vectorial model. And a cube just didn't work. It was uncomfortable. So you can see how quickly I really got into, sort of spontaneously, into your. I want to see how, but this is the way a child carries on. I'm just going, I think, of all the things I don't think anything is quite so important as naivety. Just cherish your naivety. Don't let anybody try to belittle you because they say you're naive. This is the most beautiful thing we have. So I think that I was very naive many times in the, as a sort of off character, seeing the wrong way at first with the teacher and everything, and then I didn't, with my big glasses, I was kind of an ugly looking character anyway, and never was any teacher's favorite, I assure you. In fact, often my friends discovered that to such an extent they found that they could play tricks and I'd be the one to get the blame. It was sort of a standard matter in every class I was in. Continually having to stay after school and so forth, and then they stay after school, and the teacher's rather nice and just saying, you really like mathematics very much, and I'll teach you some more. Actually, at Milton Academy, where I was, the mathematics teacher said, I think you might just well go on to, in the college mathematics. And so I went through a whole lot of mathematics when I was still in school. So simply, this is this afternoon time. And I was being penned in there anyway, so it came out fine. That's it. Our conversations would go on, and the kids didn't know what favor they were doing me. I didn't know what either. I'd like you to any time think that I'm being something abnormal or smart here. Everything that's happened in my life here so far, as far as I can see it, comes really out of the circumstances, the physical circumstances. And this, of all the things, I think is, not having, being able to see properly, nothing was quite so important. Because at 4.5, imagine if you've never seen a hair, you suddenly saw a hair. You've never seen a dewdrop before. Can you imagine? I haven't seen eyes. Particularly eyes of creatures, eyes of those kittens, and eyes of a snake. I seem to be able to talk with people with eyes. I just love snakes and toads, and they like me, and we get on and fill my blouse up with them. People holler about that, but I want you to understand, I don't think anything went on here with me. It wasn't just a very fantastically normal, average character with certain physical deficiencies at the outset, which get fixed up. Because at 4.5, I really started life all again. You imagine get a second chance. I'm sure that through the years, when things went badly, I'd say, because I couldn't see at first, but I'd say, when I don't see and I don't understand what's going on here, I think all I've got to do is to wait a little. There must be something in me psychologically that came about through that delay in a second sight, a second take, where you really suddenly understood. I think this has helped me to hold on many times to the total package. And certainly that business of not being able to see details, I was having to put together smelling and hearing and touching, which was very much less effective than the seeing. So I was using a three-way system to sort of to zero in. And so I personally, my grandson said, I'm not sure that I'm really being effective with human beings, I say this, but I'm confident the only thing that is important about this particular character, me, is that I do represent an average character more or less getting peeled off by something wrong, like the kid's fooling you, so you get peeled off the afternoon. I find myself getting isolated more and more, but giving me more and more perspective on the show. And tending then to see long distance, to put together big patterns. But I say then, as far as I'm concerned, I am very clearly a demonstration of what any human being can do. If they're disembarrassed of a game where society is trying to make you specialist, trying to, and no question about society doing what it did in great love. The grown-ups really feeling enormous affection. They're sure they're doing the right thing for their kids. There's anything but malevolence in here. So I don't think, again, you can see anything if you assume bad or good in here. You have to understand how people got caught in the picture they're in, why people, they don't, that's all they do. And you may find out something. Now, I have some more slides I'd like to go on. Something I'd like to show you here, because I find there are five of these balls, five sets of the tetrahedron been put together. Remember how when we had a tetrahedron, just look at the corner, tetrahedron in the corner, you get four tetrahedra and one octahedron in the center. Remember that? That's getting clearer and clearer to you. But I also pointed out to you that vertices and edges are not the same. So sometimes you're looking at tetrahedra and they look like this. And when you're doing that, these are entirely vertices. The spheres of little points enlarged. This is a vertexio, topologically. And then when I see that's a line, then I can make it out of solids because those are areas. There really are, these are three different topological phenomena. The counts come out differently. It's very important to realize that, because then we've got two balls here, but there's only one edge between them. That's one reason why we came out where four balls had six interrelationships. They're not the same number. So I want to show you how, what you're very familiar with now, putting a tetrahedron, four tetrahedron in each corner, and one on top. So here's a tetrahedron, another tetrahedron here, another tetrahedron sits here. Now, according to the way we've learned it in areas, where it looks like solids, then you put a tetrahedron on top and you put an octahedron inside here. That's not what you do at all. You say an octahedron. I'm going to take tetrahedron to the upside down. Excuse me. This tetrahedron, I'm going to let it in upside down. And each of these four are going to come in the middle of this. That is. Sit right down there. Now I'm going to take one more. And it sits right on top there. I got a three ball. Or a two-frequency tetrahedron made out of five tetrahedron. Here's our number five showing up quite interestingly, where you'd had an octahedral kind of four, there's a prime number difference in there. So it is very, very important not to get fooled about. It seems very neat. So vertexial associativity comes out differently from edge sociability or face sociability. In fact, vertexial sociability was the, excuse me, dear, the, do you want to have me take it out? There you're five. Hello. So, the vertexial sociability is universal joint. This is where the gases are. Huh? And edge sociability is liquids, still flexible, distributing those. And face sociability is triple bond. This is single bond, double bond, triple bond. And then we get the greatest tension, but no flexibility, no distributing loads anymore. And this is then is crystalline. This is liquid. This is gaseous. This is why suddenly found out how to integrate Willard Gibbs' phase rule dealing in the chemistries, the liquids, crystalline gases, with the topology. So I found they're all the same. And that was, again, a breakthrough. There have been very many breakthroughs in my life where you said you don't understand. For instance, there's something I'm sure you've often heard of, the four-color problem. Why do you need no more than four colors to do any mapping so that you'll always have different colors between any two areas of the map, no matter what the shapes are? And this is simply because nature does work then in tetrahedra. And a system, a map is always going to be on the surface of a system. There's no plane all by itself, no interminable plane. It's always going to be a surface. It's always going to turn out then that you've got a triangle, because you get down to triangles for the net structure, and the triangle on the outside of the sphere is the base of a tetrahedron whose center is the center of the sphere. And the tetrahedron is going to come about that way. So the tetrahedron has four colors. And the four colors, you have a red on the outside, there's a red, the blue, green, and yellow on the inside, blue, green, white on the inside. You find them, they act like gears, and every time you just have those four colors, and you have four. For one outside, you've got three buried. So it's a universe of three-way gearing. They just can't come out wrong. So you can really make a model. This then proves, for very many years, it's been said for over a century, nobody ever proved the four-color problem so far. This is fundamental, because you and I are dealing now fundamental to systems. I've been able to say absolute limit conditions all the way through. That's the simplest. And here it is. Okay. I now would like to have the next picture. This is really quite a simple one. Well, I wanted you to remember I've talked about pulling. Could you eliminate me for a minute? You have on the left-hand side pushing. And we find then it's tending to be a sphere. This is a precessional effect. You push on the two ends, and the whole thing begins to go, increases in girth. And you pull on it, and it contracts. I just want you to feel that. Now, before we go on more pictures, I'm going to go through something that relates to a statement that we made here just a few minutes ago about, I just think about children and human beings apprehending. So there is the touching and the smelling and the seeing and the hearing. And I'm sure that sometime we're going to learn about this electromagnetic, telepathetic interrelationship. But the ones we know about are the touching, smelling, hearing, so far, seeing. And I find, as I grew up, the insurance companies had equal indemnity for the loss of a hand and the loss of an eye, for instance. There was a sort of, as I grew up, there was a sort of feeling, you're being told by grown-ups, you know, you may lose your hearing, but you got your sight. They were sort of alternate faculties. That's the way they were looked at. They were not really evaluated very tightly. I felt a very great necessity to make an experiential, operational assessment of our senses. Having been then myself, now having had the seeing of the outset, and having primarily the hearing and the smelling and the touching, because as I was young, I can't tell you how much I smelled. The smelling was very, very, I really was almost like a dog. And I knew people by their smells. To such an extent, and my scholar said that just in the last few years, my sensitivity of smell is going down, like my hearing, it seemed to be nervous, the nerves are breaking down. But through my life, smelling had been so, I always really smelled people. First, it was the first thing about them, and if they smelt wrong to me, they were not going to be my kind of a pal, that's all. There's no question about the smelling. When they looked great, but didn't smell right, I just learned you turn away, but you know, they're going to just be trouble. So, now I'm going to go into this assessment of our nerves. And I would like to make a good experiment on a good scientific basis now. And I'm going to do it. Take my body and I'm going to bandage up my mouth and my nose. I'm going to give myself an oxygen tube so I won't be asphyxiated. I'm not going to use it, so I just know that oxygen is very powerful in there, but that's not what I'm dealing in here. It's not going to give me information. I'm going to cover up my ears. I'm covering up my eyes, but all blindfolded. I have my body. I'm naked. And I need to get some information. And certainly, I'm not going to, in any unknown territory, I'm not going to step over here. I have no experience to tell me that I step there and keep my balance on this foot. I'm going to try it very, very much before I ever throw any real weight there to keep testing ice. So I'm also going to be, I don't want something to run my head into things too, so I'm going to be doing this. As I move along, I'm going to be being very, very tentative, and every way I'll be acting like an insect. And under these conditions, I find that I will also begin to get a little familiar with the floor, and I'll get to know it. I have a good angular sense, and I sort of feeling of orientation like this, if I turn like that, it's going to be like that. I can really feel what comes next here, because it really is a pivotal effect. You're going to learn just exactly what it's like on your feet. I don't know if you've ever done this as a child, but off in the country, if there's a place that you've just really enjoyed yourself tremendously, little kid, and they let you get out at night alone, and you find that their paths, you get so familiar, the feeling of the paths with your feet, that you can run down that path at night really quite fast, even though you can't see it. Foggy night, you still feel very, very comfortable with your feet. So I would say then, if you just had the touch, you'd gradually learn about a certain amount of territory. And it could be fairly large territory. You feel very comfortable. Within that territory, you would dare run. But with just my legs and as short as they are, I'm not going to cover very much of my planet Earth, that's obvious. The information that I would get, because I'm also going to be watching this run through the night, and I've learned that other things some fall in there once in a while, so you can't be too sure about the space until you're going to be doing this as you're running along like this. So I see then that the limit of the information that I can reach just standing still, as I start off, is a limit between one toe of one foot and the finger of another. This is the total. This is considerably more than my height. I'm going to have a very tough, tall basketball player. I'm going to give him 10 feet stretch from his toe to his fingertip. Just keep it a simple number. I simply say then, under the conditions of just touch, you have a static range of 10 feet. But under the, you and I can run possibly up to, say, like 5 miles an hour. And the amount of time that in a total lifetime, say, all the days, about how much, you and I would have a dynamic thing where I could run, say, 5 miles an hour to get information, plus a static reach of 10 feet. So I'm going to put that on the board here. We got on a tactile basis. I'm going to have a range, a static range and a dynamic range. The static range is going to be 10 feet, and this is going to be 5 miles an hour, 5 mph. A mile is about 5,000 feet. So if I divide 5,000 by 10 to get down to 500, well, this is 1/500. This is a, so I'm going to call it 1/500th of miles per hour. Because I want to get in relative to miles. Now the next thing we have, I'm going to cover up all my skin so I can't get any information from my skin. So then I'm running, I got information all over my body for some reason. And I also felt heat. So now I'm going to cover my whole body. And I can't, because I would also, just by, I would not come too close to fire. I'd feel that heat. I'd feel the coal this way. It'll do a whole, you get a lot of information right. But now, I've covered up all my skin, and I can't move anymore. I'm not allowed to do that. And I open up my nostrils. My eyes are covered, my ears are covered. That's all I have, and what can I learn? We have learned that sailors, time and again in history, on sailing ships, coming in from long sea voyages, have been able to smell citrus groves or pine at sea with no wind, there's calm, a mile offshore. You can smell pine and citrus a mile away. So I've got a static in this new one. This is now the olfactory. And I have in that a 1 mile static against the 1/500th. And you can smell without, that is 1 mile static. But if the wind is blowing, it could bring you a lot of smells. And how fast can the wind blow? Well, at Earth's level, we have 400 miles an hour on some of the stratosphere, but the level of which you and I operate, fastest we have down the Antarctic, so 180 miles an hour. So that with 180 miles an hour, your smells can be brought to you, and often we get forest fires, information about them, really considerable distance, but I've taken the static, the air's dispelled, they get thinner and thinner, so that the mile is far as you get to the car. So there's a dynamic additive to the smelling. So I'll give you 200 miles an hour dynamic added to the smelling. So I didn't really do this column very well. I'll leave this, these are all MPH here anyway. So we had 1/500th and 5, this we have 1 mile static, but I've got to give you 200 miles an hour in the dynamic. Now we're going to cover up your nose and all your skin and open the ears for the first time, eyes are covered up. What do we know about this? We know that humans have heard the atomic bomb blast in the desert 100 miles away. That's not usual. If it's just you and I trying to shout to one another, we can hear explosion considerably further than we can shout to one another, so I have to use explosion. And the atomic bomb blast is the biggest, so we have to use, the static here is 100 miles an hour. This we're now dealing in hearing. And then your speed of sound in air is 700 miles an hour, but if the air is blowing your way, it makes it come 900 miles an hour. Actually makes it come, it can blow towards you or blow away from you, because it is in the air. So we have to have, there is then a dynamic additive, so this gets up to be 900 miles an hour. Now I cover up all those touch, smell, and hear, and open my eyes for the first time. And as I've been going in with you, man, you can see a galaxy a million light years away. I find that the range is so incredibly large, if I try to put down what it is I'm seeing, I'll have to take that's a good one, the 1 million light years away. So we take our million and we multiply it times 6.5 trillion miles per year. So 6.5 trillion, so what do you have here? You have your 6 zeros in your 1 million, and your trillion you have 9 zeros. So you have 6.5 times 1, so 6.5 times 1, and you have 6 and 9, you've got 15 zeros, you've got times 10 to the 15th power. This is the number of miles that you and I are seeing, 6.5 times 10 to the 15th power. And if you want to say it out, we'd have then, so it said 15 zeros, so let's put it down that way. So we're saying, this is millions, billions, trillions, quadrillions, sextillions. we're seeing us, we can say see a sextillion miles. So this is the sight. So it is a credit, an incredible figure. So is this something I have to write it ten times, ten to the 15th power? It was six times that. Okay, then the I've got that is a static range. Then to that I have to add the velocity. That was the actual number of miles I saw. So the velocity which I see is then also then the 700 million miles an hour. That's my velocity. Now if I try to make a chart to plot these things, you find that these first three are really pretty close to one another. So I can get them on my chart all right, but for the fourth faculty, the seeing, I'm going to have to take an airplane and I'll be going quite a long while before I come to the point where I plot them. So I find that the first three senses are really very closely coordinated, and the seeing one is very remote from them. So the fact that I had the first three at the beginning put me in a very pedestrian kind of a way, and you imagine the excitation of receiving this one secondarily. But I think the kids probably using the first one primarily and not really realizing what a jump up it is. So again, I think this is part of why circumstance happened to take a very average character, in fact, a fairly efficient average character, and get it into all this trouble. You find me continually then trying to find hierarchies of the experience, trying to get total experience all under one chart. This is my proclivity all the time. And now this tells me a lot more. When a child is born, I'm sure many of you, all of you, have been near a newborn child, whether it's your sisters, your mothers, or some friends. And the child is lying there, and if you notice, its hands seem to move rather deftly. At first, they can move their heads and subtly and so forth, but their hands, and these motions are sort of spasmodic, the legs, you know, but the hands seem to close. You'll find yourself tempted, and I've talked, so many people do, because I know immediately I had a temptation to put my finger in the child's hand, and sure enough, it closed on me, just as deft as could be. It's amazing. See, it feels as though this child is starting talking through my hand. I like to take my hand away, so it immediately opens up. So I start to pull it away, open it right up, accommodates. We together, immediately couples up. Now, this ought not to surprise us, because the child has been in tactile communication with its mother for months. It can't see, it can't hear, it can't smell in the room, but it feels. So the tactile is there. The tactile is already operative when the child comes out, highly developed, very sophisticated feeling. So it's considerably later that the next thing comes in outside the room is then the olfactory smelling for the udder, so we're going after milk. Then considerably later, the child begins to hear. And the very last thing it does is to see. We find then there is a hierarchy of relative magnitudes of effectiveness, but they are employed in that order. So the first one that is used is the tactile, second is the olfactory, the next is the hearing, and finally the seeing. This again, when you find such an agreement of hierarchies, of rates of use and so forth, makes you think a little more about it. So when I begin to think about things I might do on behalf of the new life in the way of developing environments that will have available within them the means for the child to acquire what it wants to acquire in the way of information, because that's what it's going after all the time, information. Couldn't be more after information. And it's absolutely nothing to interfere with it, with that information. And so I'd like to have it, get it safely, yet not, I'd like it to know that it's going to, it can't hurt. It's just like it's going to hurt, no, it's going to hurt. You've got to have some feeling about what that gravity does. But I'd like it not to know it gets hurt, but not so you're going to be done away with it. You're going to get damaged, you know, the equipment damaged. So I'm sure all those things are designable. And they must be thought of in this kind of intimacy. Now, something I've just gone through some very simply with you here, but this brought me to an awareness. And because the touching is already operative, I find all the other faculties are weighted in the terms, relatively, of the touching. So you say it is feet away, touch. Listen to the feet. Feet are hands high and so forth. That's where man began talking. And I find then that all the things he does is rated back again to the tactile. That's it. That's a big one. To such an extent, here comes to me a shocker. I find that you only see what you could touch. You don't know me by what I'm saying. You don't know me by my hearing, what I'm smelling. You know me by my touch. The dog tends to know me by my smell. But we just absolutely take the absolute limit case that you only begin when I touch you, which is exactly what you're not you. Now I say if it may be, it could be that Democritus is sitting here with us, but every time I say the word atom, Democritus is here. He invented the word, he had a conception. Democritus is absolutely immortal. As long as you ever hear the word atom, there's Democritus. So I say, what we really are, if you had been really paralyzed on your tactile with your room, then you'd probably begin where you smell me. And maybe a shorter time in the womb of a dog then makes it want to be much more smelling. You understand? But the point being that also then if you'd been tactilely paralyzed and had no smelling, then I would be where you hear me. That's actually what I'd be. And if you'd had the other three paralyzed, then I'd be where you can see me. And what you see would be something very, very different, I'm sure. You'd probably see my emotions rather than what we really be, I don't know. But this really gave me insight on how incredibly, as very beginnings of things we really are in our upending, that we continue to come back to the tactile, to such an extent to put on special clothes or whatever it is, just make it look different. Put on a mask, and the child comes around, and there's no question about those masks are very powerful. The Africans lived it long ago. The mask is a mask. Boy. Going to come back to pictures. I ought to have something I say after I say come back to pictures. Now, we're looking at remember I gave you degrees of freedom, where there's myself in the universe. I think that could be put sideways. Could that be put sideways? So, it's only showing two, and there are four frames. The top one, it's where you are the tether ball, and the now turn sideways and you'll see it where the there it is. The tether ball is way on the left. Then the next one you see yourself in a plane where the three make a plane. You can find that you'll move. You're looking at the degrees of freedom and you're allowed to make a plane. And I'm sorry to say the tension line is, gravity is to your right, so that the gravity is pulling the thing sideways, and the top ball you can see is free, and then the next cartoon, you can see the ball moving around in the plane, as it did in the middle of a music string. And the third one, you can see it moving only in a line, as it did in the middle of a drum head. And the fourth one, you see it immobilized as far as locality goes, in order to prevent it from wriggling locally, rotating, then we had to have the 12 restraints. The next picture, please. I've got here a water spout. The upper one there is a tornado or water spout, where we get the airs get disturbed and they get rotated, get a thermal, and all air currents, like all ropes, they always twist. The thermal is twisting, and gradually it gets sucking so much that it pulls the dust into it. It is absolutely invisible until it gets the dust into it. What you see with a tornado is all, everything is sucking up there. They're full of, loaded with debris. I've also then taken that funnel twister and put a knot in it up there, on the right, upper right hand side. Then the next one, I have three twisters or three water storms, and they're twisting to make a piece of rope. I want you to realize then what goes on with this twister is that it finally it sends out, and it comes back in itself like this. It's finally be an apple shape. It's our friend involuting and evoluting. It's evoluting at the top, and it's involuting at the bottom. Because these airs being exhausted this way, automatically pull us in areas that tend to satisfy us. So what you're looking at up there now, the lower left, you're seeing the beginning sort of the bomb, bikini bomb, where you can see it spreading at the top. And the second one, you see the rolling dome, and then you see the third and the middle one at the bottom is the electromagnetic field, the magnetic field around our Earth gets to be this kind of a form. Now, we're looking at the reality of those electromagnetic fields here. Very extraordinary, the space picture of it. Next picture, please. Now I'm seeing this is the atomic bomb. It's starting to spread the mushroom. Next picture. This next picture was the cover picture on life of the first bikini atomic bomb explosion. And it's an amazing one. It comes out. It's a geodesic dome. And you'll find it again coming out. It's one of regular geodesics. And it is a three-frequency geodesic. As this thing finally gets really shaping itself towards the sphere, then suddenly these are the least resistant forms. Very, very exciting. Next picture. What we're looking at here, you can see it's highly geodesic, and it is the model made for me by one of the early virologists. This is the polio virus, and it is strictly the icosahedron. This man was a physicist at the Boston Children's Hospital, and he now works primarily with the Cavendish Laboratory Group. Next picture. Now you're looking at something else that's going to look kind of familiar, kind of geodesic, with the hexes and the pence, and because we get those kind of spaces. And what you're looking at how is the actual fibrous web this is the eye, an eye, eye of a bull. Also, incidentally, the bull's testicle comes out exactly the same time, but all the eye structures are this way. These are the eye structures. I want you to see, it's fantastic how these suddenly things show up, and as I get again more and more scientist friends who are interesting. I'm saying this. This was sent to me by a Viennese biophysicist, and he realized how interested I'd be. Next picture. Looking here at pictures, if you could remove me again from the picture, what we're looking at are pictures made of the radiolaria. This is when the voyaging of the British scientific ship and Darwin went on and so forth. These are pictures of the sea life, and we have these particular ones are radiolaria, but we have also the diatoms tend to be in these same kind of forms. Next picture, please. And incidentally, look at what you're looking at are the central angles of the tetrahedron. This is the one I found I could not make with great circles, fold up. And incidentally, this reminds you about those great circles, that there were seven great circles that were foldable, and they all had to do with the energy bank either going through space or cutting it off in local holding patterns. And there are no others that can be folded. These are limit cases, there are only seven. And they all have to do with this basic symmetry. Now, next picture. Here you're looking at some more of the radiolaria and the algae. These are not the algae, and the diatoms. Look at the octahedron and the really, really very beautiful thing. Would you remove me, get me out of the way of this ray, because it's very, remove my picture. I want you to see the lower left-hand corner, there's the dodeca, and there's the octahedron up the upper left-hand corner, so it goes the tetrahedron upper right. They're all there. These are them, and you get the sea life, absolutely the simplest things coming together in the simplest ways, and this is where they go. Again, this confirms what I want you to do, get the very simplest, and here we are. Next picture. Now we've got a stack of ping pong balls with a red ping pong ball on the top. And I spoke to you, I'm going through pretty much what I went through with yesterday, but there's going to be more added to it each time. I want you to be really very familiar. There's one red ball on the top. In other words, it is the only potential nucleus you and I can be looking at. Let's take the next picture, please. And be a good idea if I were out of the way for these pictures. I've just taken off the top tetrahedron, and you can see the six balls at the top and no ball in the center, right? Next picture, please. And eliminate me again, that's fine. So then you see, I'm now down with the four balls to the edge. It's a three frequency. Now there's a new nucleus showing for the first time. There's the first red ball on the table to the left, then the two layers that have no ball at the center, then the fourth layer has a ball at the center. Next picture. Now no ball in the next layer, five layers. Next picture. No ball again, that one. Next picture. Next, and there we suddenly come to. So I said, it's a yes, yes, no, no, yes, no, no, yes, no, no, all the way through. And these are the fundamental distances that make the fundamental distance from between nuclei. And that yes, no, no also has a great agreement. Remember when I was spinning the great circle yesterday, the red yes, no, no, that happened very, very often. And it's, where we get to the nature of taking one out, remember by giving you the going from the octahedron to the three tetrahedron face to face. I think I'll do that again because it is worth our doing at the moment. Here's our octahedron, absolutely symmetrical. It's generalized. It's very much in the middle because tetrahedron is the minimum case, icosahedron is the maximum case of structural system. It's the middle ground. And we find it has a tendency to be doubled up. It obviously has a storage. It's that fundamental two-ness of universe that are all in one. And so it's having two extremes, but it is in the middle, so it's two or something. And I'm going to take one out, one vector out. And just taking it out momentarily, now I'm going to put it right back in, but I'm going to precess it. Remember, precessing goes like that. There's a precessing effect on it. So it goes in here. It goes in here. And what we have now are triple-bonded tetrahedra. One tetrahedron here, second tetrahedron, a third. So the volume is three, and the volume was four when it was 18. So you're literally annihilated. But all the energies are here, because the energies are the edges, are the vectors. I want you to understand this is all there is in the universe, in physics, about annihilation. But the interesting thing about it is it gets to be the beginning of the tetrahelix. So we're going from the generalized immediately going into the special case. It's a very, very exciting realization. Okay. Next picture, please. Next picture. Now you see up at the upper right the two red balls, and there are always two layers between them. And what that makes, quite interestingly, is two tetrahedra, but two tetrahedra made of balls rather than, so this behaved differently, you see. If they were planar, they could come face to face. But these don't do that. The balls nest. They go this 60-degree precession. So there are the two red balls, and what do you have in between? Six balls, and those are the octahedron. So these two red balls are an octahedron. There's a basic symmetry between two nuclei, two potential nuclei. That's all that is saying. That's interesting, because it is not that kind of tetrahedron, it's this kind of tetrahedron. It's a nested tetrahedron. And if these two were joints, they would come together and you wouldn't see them, because they would become congruent as they would bond together. Okay, next picture. This is a repetition of the one ball, the three balls, the six balls, the 10 balls, and so forth. Next picture. And this is a little review of thinking about, instead of calling a nucleus, I called it the ability to nest. So that one case I'm talking about positively, this is a new nucleus showing up. On the other hand, there's an advantage of being a space where you can nest. Begins with the tetrahedron, second is the 1/8 octahedron, the third is the 1/4 tetrahedron. So these are fundamental increments of the universe. That's really actually spelled out by fundamental disassociability. That you feel much more comfortable about using quarter tetrahedron and really looking at things that way once you discover that. So, next picture. Now I've got two balls on a wire, and other two balls in the wire. And I want you to see what they are doing. They are remote from one another, the pairs. May I have the just picture? You can leave. No, you want to put me in this picture. What happens to these two balls is that they near each other, and the effect of motion is they precess, so they do this and they do this. Realize how one half of the tetrahedron is really precessed to the other half, the pairs. Linus Pauling does a great deal of these kind of spheres, and he's a Nobel Prize chemist. And we'll see some of his models after a little bit here. And they do relation, and he said, because the numbers of the vertices in the universe do come out evenly, all the sphere agglomerations in the universe can be divided into pairs. They're twos. The universe can be divided up into fundamental tuneness. So there is a multiplicative tuneness and the additive tuneness. This is a multiplicative tuneness. So this is one sphere. It's inside this, outside. You see them both at the same time. Next picture, please. It's when the two balls are coming together precessionally. Next picture. Making a tetrahedron. Next picture. Now we see three balls in a row, and three balls, and four balls. I'm going to make a model of this. And don't go any further with your picturing for the moment, because I'd like to make this model up for you with my pens and the sphere. Here's three in a row. I talk about nuclear phenomena, how different patterns obtain at different levels, so that I get the two balls just precessing and say, that's very simple. Everything else must do that. Then I got a couple of sets of three balls there. I'm going to have to make a pair. You make another pair. There are two pairs, but this time I'm not going to precess them. I'm going to... They're not in the precessing part of the story. So I'm going to run one thing perpendicularly there, another one perpendicularly. And I'm going to make them into a square, which would not be valid if they were all by themselves, because a square wouldn't hold its shape. Now, we have that precessing is something to tetrahedra tend to precess. So I find that what happens here, this wants to do this, but it just would roll around and it wouldn't be stable. What we have then, this is here, and this one's here, and now it goes like that. So then there's a three-ball tetrahedron. Once here, this how this precessing is then accommodated by the square in the center. That square is also then the cross-section of the octahedron. It is the center of the four tetrahedra. Well, it's getting into an octahedral kind of a condition. In fact, if I took all the four balls away from the four corners, you find you have the octahedron sitting in there. That's really quite different from when I put a four-ball edge, say, that main, and there were five tetrahedra. But this one has the octahedron in the center. So things are coming out quite differently in different layers here. As the frequencies exchange, something unique is going on. Now, the next thing I'm going to do for you, you're going to be able to see in the picture. May I have the next picture after the one that I had last shown? So there you see the two of those that came together, so three-ball edge, which is two frequencies, remember? That's two frequencies. Next picture. Now you've got four balls in a row at the upper left, then four balls in a row at the bottom right. And on top of the group at the bottom, you have see six balls. And you're going to see the six balls and the one on the left. Just keep that, and I've got to make another model. This one. Maybe somebody come here and help me making this model. We just take our pins and we could do it. And it's good to leave that model. Make four in a row like that now. The pin. Look out, you don't hurt. Now you make up a set of three pairs. And you got your three pairs. All right, now. Where I made the square, pin them together in parallel. It makes a group like that. I need another expert. Would you be an expert then? When you make what she's made four in a row, now you've got your six here there put together, fasten those to your four. Now, I have had a very interesting time with these particular pieces in the past. Now, I have made this model many times. And, universities with top universities, say Dartmouth, what it may be, and I've had the top mathematicians and so forth. And I've given them this to a mathematician, and there's another one just like it. You've been with me now so much you know what to do. But I just give these two items, and particularly if I make it paper. I make this a paper. In fact, I can't make it paper. I can only make it the balls. So here are two of them, exactly the same. I say, put those together. And he said, he's got to find something symmetrical. So he finds a six and tries that. Or you try this like that, doesn't seem to do anything. You just, because the six are a rectangle with completely different dimensions, there's no reason in the world why you would think any way to put them together except by the sixness. The way people tend, because they think 90-degreeness. They don't think 60-degreeness. 6-degreeness is always convergent. They're thinking parallel motions. So what you do again is cross precess. It's this lovely thing. So six, all right, but they converge. I find human eyes just don't think that way. I really had very distinguished mathematics, and they never catch it. My grandson and I were, he accompanied me for a whole year around, we went to 50 different universities last year. And we were at Rhode Island, and there's a little girl, the professor's daughter. She was getting quite good at school. She was about 10. And I gave her a model of this. We had to leave. And she couldn't get it. So I showed her. My grandson said, "Grandpa, you cheated that little child." I said, "You never get it. This is what you got to find out for yourself. You had given her the child, she would have found out," he said. "And you cheated that child the right to find out. And well, if you did find out, then you'd feel the 60-degreeness. You'd have to explain it to yourself if you found out for yourself. But just telling you like that, you lose the whole beauty of it." So this is one of my most beautiful lessons I've ever had. It's still part of that, how to get on with a child. But I was amazed how my nonsense is an older man wanting to feel gratification. I thought, really? I want to be big, you show off to the kids. So, the big thing is here, the 60-degree convergence. Everything is converging and diverging. That's the way nuclear things are. They converge and diverge. They don't parallel them. And all of humanity keep working on parallel lines and cubes and squares. That's not the way the universe is. So when you begin to think convergent, divergent, then things really fit. Now, next picture, please. Now, there's the one I just put together. Next picture. Now you see a really very big one. This is a very exciting one. They are, count the edges, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. That'd be 7 frequency. Next picture. Take these two apart. There they are. And the two parts are hollow. And they're very strange. This is even more provoking. When I make this one up, it's so big I don't want to try to stop you to do it. But there are, in each half there, 50 balls. So the two balls coming together have exactly 100 balls. And I find, because they are hollow, they do really surprise people. Now, what they have inside is exactly room for a four-ball edge, which is a 3-frequency, just goes inside. And it has, we may remember, exactly 20 balls. When I put these together, 4 times 5. What fits inside the one that's up in the wall is 20-ness, and the enclosure is 100. So I could get, and we know there's no ball in the center of this group. Remember, there's a tetrahedron there. It's a sphere. Centered absolutely space. So a 20 ball is an absolute space in the center. So I can get 100 on the outside, I can get 120 balls around a common vacant nucleus. This is the largest number of balls I really can do. Now, the next thing, if I want to have a nucleus, then I'd have to put one more layer on the 120, and then you suddenly have a nucleus. Next picture. Now you see something else rather interesting. Remember that I showed you the nestability of the tetrahedron. Let you make a 3-ball edge tetrahedron. No, 3-ball edge triangle, that's all.
Okay.
All right. Now, that is nestable. So fasten that one in the center. I'd like to make another one of the same. To make another one just like that. That is the second case of nestability, remember? I told you it is a 1/4, 1/8 octahedron. And if you're making 1/8 octahedron, you'll find sure enough the angle is exactly right. And I'm going to ask you to do something logical with these two pieces. Something that feels good to everybody. We've been talking about precession. How could you precess? What could possibly match there? You match the little faces of the tetrahedron. Somebody else want to try? What else could you match? The triangle faces. Yeah. Now, let me tell you, when you finish, you'll know you're right. You get so close to it, it makes me. I bet you see it. Precess. There it is. Put it down on the floor. It's a cube. You got it. These pins are bad. Come near me. I'll fix the pin in there. Isn't this? That's a cube. Beautiful cube. Just put it down the floor if you can.
I didn't even recognize it.
That's because those angles, remember, were the right angles. It's quarter eight, and 90 degrees in those cones. It's 1/8 octane. So 2 1/8 octane, you get a cube. They would not do it just by themselves. In planar, they would not do it this way. They got to do it only in the balls of vertexes. Next picture. That's going to be up in here in the show. Now you see a big cube. So the big cube is going to find on each corner out of the big cube is one of those 1/8 octahedra. And it is a big cube, is those corners have been put onto a vector equilibrium. Next picture, there's a vector equilibrium. You're taking the 1/8 octahedra off of the corners of the cube, and that is your vector equilibrium. And it is a, we'll count the numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, is the 4 frequency vector equilibrium. And that really is the limit case of the nucleus. I'm quite certain that you would get into the post-uranians because you get outside of the 92 because they're still, this range where it still is a nucleus. Next picture. Now you're looking at an icosahedron made out of balls, but you cut off the balls so they're down to the planar side so you can see what the balls look like together. That's the icosahedron where they there's no ball at the center. Next picture. You'll see when you do the counting, whether it's vector equilibrium or it is the icosahedron, you'll find, if you cut the balls away like that, the pole ones, the plus two-ness, is quite clearly as a different color than the others. The other faces get together where I gave you three come together with two, with one, or whatever it may be, but you'll see all the triangles coming together, giving the second power area. But the numbers of balls in the outer layer will be frequency the second power, and then the poles are plus two, and you always see the balls are right there. The count is there every time. It's a really very beautiful thing. Next picture. These particular models are supposed to show it to you, and somehow or other they faded away. You can see the icosahedron there. This is where you get the multi-frequencies, and I want you to understand how well they work for the single, just the plain tetrahedron. Well, you see then, 30 faces to the 20 faces icosahedron, they break into 10 diamonds. Remember how the diamonds then come? So you're looking at 10 diamonds grasping each other here, of blacks and whites. That's always one extra north pole, one extra south pole. It's a lovely thing, make the count. Next picture. There it is, that's vector equilibrium, and the poles have been identified there. Next picture. This coloring is really quite badly faded. That's the same one you saw as vector equilibrium becoming the icosahedron. But it cannot have any layers inside, or it will not be able to collapse into it. So no matter what the frequency is, it has to, the icosahedron closer back surface, it can only be one layer. And I'm quite certain this has to do with its electronness. The icosahedron's electronness cannot have the nucleus, but it has the same count as the vector equilibrium, which is the nucleus. Next picture. You're looking at pictures made by Linus Pauling. or rather models that he made, and from his Nobel laureate book, a paper. There you see, one of the things he does, well, I take the vector equilibrium, and we have, he takes the top three balls and rotates them. Because remember, there's six nests up on top here, and we only use three. There's three alternate ones that you do. The minute you rotate, the top end becomes polarized. It's absolutely omnidirectionally equilibrious. Until you take the three top and rotate them, it becomes polarized. And when you polarize, take the three top, so you get 12 balls, three balls in a box, three balls like that. Then you get around the equator, you get pairs of squares, pairs of triangles, pairs of squares, and then a triangle and triangle on top. So that it is completely polarized. And when you make a section through the polarized vector, what used to be vector equilibrium, so no longer equilibrium because it's polarized, then a cross section is the chemical hex. So I want to bring you in some proximity with other phenomena that you, because all of hexes have to do with polarization, where things, you never will catch nature in that vector equilibrium. She's always going to be in the polarized, she's going to be always offset one way or the other. Next picture. These are more Linus Pauling's pictures. Next picture are polarized sets, how he can bring together threeness and various, but they're all polarized. Now, the top one is a vector equilibrium, and it's got a red ball inside, and you knock the red ball out of the center, and comes the icosahedron. You make a rubber model like this, you just have them fastened together, rubber bands, pull the one out, and it's immediately snap in the vector equilibrium set. The icosahedron. Next picture. Now we're looking at the three on the top, which you do rotate. Next picture. To go, I want to show how from the polarized to the vector equilibrium, just rotate. Next picture. Now we're going to look at a little larger vector equilibrium of the four balls to the edge, so it's a three frequency vector equilibrium. And then notice then there's a triangular face towards us, and there's a red ball at the center. There's a new nucleus beginning to show in the eight faces. It will not be a nucleus still. It has its two layers around it. So this is the one that has 92 balls in the outer layer that I gave you yesterday, 42 in the inner, and 12 in the innermost. Now I've opened that up so you can see all the different layers as they come together. And these balls have different colors when the amount of light that they get from the nucleus are different. So I talked to you about trying to find a nuclear set of events that would repeat itself. And so I get absolute uniqueness with those first three, four, up to the four, and the fifth begin to get something repeating. But these colors relate then to the amount of light or radiation available, or the fraction from the central nucleus to any given that layer ball. Next picture. You see on the top one, the corners, 12 corners, are always direct contact where the light goes right through them. Next picture. This is a picture taken through one of my models where I've used the beads, which Matty found over there the other day. They're lovely, lovely beads that developed during World War I, very uniform radius, and they're glued together. And I used to, they're all transparent, but some of them are colored. You're looking at the vector equilibrium. You can remove me now, so I'm not in the way of the picture. And I want you to see what really quite extraordinary kind of thing. The bright white lights of the 12 corners, you see how they go. This is simply giving, there is a red at the center. It gives you a little sense of what I mean by the relative amount of light that can come through to different balls in different positions. And this particular model, you find an enormous agreement with much of the light emission microscope kind of things of atoms. Next picture. Now, I spoke about spaces between spheres. And here's a tetrahedron. Wait a second, do you have the picture still? I'm doing this so you can really look at the picture on the wall, because it's well done. There's a space then inside here. And what do we know about it? Well, it's got four balls around it. If I made this out of ping pong balls and glued them together, then I took a safety razor and cut away everything except between, we find then there's a little triangle, a concave triangle up at the top here, nesting down, touching three others, making Would you remove my picture from here? Over the left-hand side, that you'll see them coming together. There are four triangles, and there are four spaces. Therefore, it's the octahedron. It's a concave octahedron. So the center of the tetrahedron, the concave octahedron. And I'm going to make a octahedron. Here are three. And three. That's why I'm precess. That becomes the octahedron. If I'd done that before you did the cube one, you might have thought of it. But there's your octahedron. Now, the octahedron then has six balls. And you see a square section. And you remember then how when we made the three balls, it had a square section in there. You really feel those things. And so there are six balls, and they make a square section. So when the six balls touch each other, each ball touches each other with a square section. See the top one here? If it glued in the ping pong ball, and I cut away everything, it would leave me a concave square. So there's six concave squares where the six balls are. That also then, there are eight triangular windows because there's the octahedron. So what you'll have then, next picture, will be the vector equilibrium, the concave vector equilibrium, with the six concave squares and the eight triangular windows. These are all the spaces that are. There are only two kinds of spaces between closest back spheres, concave octahedra and concave vector equilibrium. And they are pretty interesting because you start with a vector equilibrium and it goes down to that octahedron where the things double up. So it looks like could be that the openness doubles up to itself, to its octahedron in its own spaces here. Something to do with that. Next picture, please. Now I'm going to take the other pictures of these. Here we're doing that in a really rather open frame, so you can see the vector equilibrium with its the octahedron on the left and the concave vector equilibrium on the right. Next picture. Now we can see two vector equilibria coming together with one another. I showed you the square faces come to one another, and that there's an octahedron between the two. Remember that? That then left the space the outside for so there's an external and internal octahedron in relation to the vector equilibrium. Next picture. Now, what you're seeing there are a number of the actual ping pong balls. In the lower right-hand side are the concave octahedron. In the lower middle right side are the concave vector equilibrium. So you put the little triangular windows of both together, making the edges match. And together they come to make them whole, fill all space. But you get a set of an aggregate of balls where you see the convexive is outside. You see only the concave side. This looks very much as if, I don't know whether you've must have done it, picking up fossils where clams have been fossilized into clay. And the clam died in between, so the two clam shells come about. So what you see is the concave side of shells together in the clay matrix. That's what it looks like. But if you keep putting these together, and they keep filling all the space, but the outer group will always be in the concave side. So what we're now seeing is really very interesting. There's some relationship between spaces and spheres. And remember that there were nests that you didn't use, because the aggregate of the three only lets you use one set of the nests at a time. There's an alternate set of nests, which are also then the spaces that are in there, and there are two kinds, the octahedron and the vectahedron. Now, next pictures. I'm looking at an aggregate here of vector equilibria plus octahedra, where there are octahedra. The external octahedra are put in between the on the outside triangular faces of the vector equilibrium, and the interior octahedra go in between the two square faces. You're going to see some more pictures. Oh. Next picture. That is a vectric limb with the four removable, borrowable spheres in the four faces, which is very, very important to chemical compounding. Next picture. Now you see red vector equilibria and a white, you see a white octahedron, which is this is the external octahedron, which nests down between any four, because they're triangular corners on every vector equilibrium, and when you bring eight of them come together more or less cubically, and they have an octahedron between them. Next picture. Now you're looking at red, I'm sorry to say, there are red-yellow ones, and there are white ones. Every other one of those, one is where a sphere is going to be, and the other where the space is going to be. They could all be actually cubes, and you stack a bunch of cubes together, as you know you can, close packing. But if you then realize that where the corners of the cubes come together are where the external octahedra are, and where the faces of the cubes come together are the internal octahedrons. That is a pack that you are looking at right now, but I want you to realize then you're going to find in closest packing that the arrangement of centers of spheres and centers of spaces is this arrangement, where you're going to suddenly discover that the vector equilibrium, I gave you originally vector equilibrium flat, remember? And then I gave you where you curved the edges, where it came convex, or it could be concave. The same vector equilibrium then can come concave, or it could come convex, and so can the octahedron. So we have then spaces that suddenly become spheres, they grow up, and the spaces contract. It's terribly exciting going on here. Next picture. Now you're looking at, would you remove me again? You're looking at a steel frame, it's a cubical frame, and there are brass rods, wires that run with a cubic frame. I told you that the perpendiculars to the faces of the vector equilibrium are the same as the perpendiculars to the four faces of the tetrahedron, which is our basic system of all. If you run there are eight corners to the cube, and so if I run a line from one corner of the cube diagonally down through the cube to the opposite corner down the floor, I get then four diagonals for the eight corners, and they are the lines that are perpendicular to the faces of the tetrahedron, or the eight triangles of the vector equilibrium. I've now mounted in there. You remember how I made the jitterbug. And the jitterbug, then, remember, can go from being open to vector equilibrium. It can become octahedron. And what you're looking at, I put little transparent plastic, they use plexiglass, red triangles and white triangles. And I mounted them on the rods. Could I go back to the picture itself now? You're going to see there are eight octahedrons showing there. But if you look very carefully, you're going to see some white or clear sheets. Those are the vector equilibria. There are vector equilibria, and the octahedra, those are the external octahedra. Now, on each of those triangles has we put a stovepipe rivet to it, a journal made of brass. We're able to mount those triangles that are on the rods. The triangles' corners are tied together with a little Dacron thread, so that they are vector equilibria. So the vector equilibrium is open, and the red ones are vector equilibria that are closed into the octahedron state, like this. We found on that frame, we put carbon dust so everything was slide at very best. I took one pencil and pushed one face of one vector, the white clear vector equilibrium, the open, just push on one face, just one force operating the whole system, and the vector equilibrium collapse, all the vector equilibrium collapse, and all the red arteries open up. But it's a very three-way kind of affair, I assure you, because due to the being internal and external octahedral. But what happens when I push on that, every sphere becomes a space, every space becomes a sphere. Now you come to this kind of an aggregate, for instance, in a liquid, you have to see how you pierce through a liquid. Because the spheres keep going out, keep coming to space. This to me is a very extraordinary matter, because now this is made symmetrically. There are the eight octahedra that you see showing, and there are the same number, yes, there are the same number of vector equilibria, and they simply interchange. In this model, because they're all mounted on those wires, as remember, this thing rotates, it opens. Therefore, the corners of the triangles take a little more space. And there are a number of other models I'm going to be showing you in tomorrow and Monday, in which you'll see then tetrahedras rotating in cubes. It's a fascinating thing, but they do. So absolutely beautiful through cubes. Anyway, you'll find that the way tetrahedra rotate in cubes makes the cube sides bulge all upside like this. So when I make one sphere become a space in the system, and every space become a sphere, all the wires bulge outwardly symmetrically, pulse outwardly like this. The changing from sphere to space, it makes it do this. You see for the first time, remember when we drop a stone in the water, see a wave. This first time you see electric magnetic wave being propagated. Actually, the model does it. Can I go to the next picture, please? Because you'll see that it happened. Now all the red octahedra opened in the vector equilibrium form, and all the little white octahedra nested. I have this model in our Cambridge office. It's quite old. It is 1951, 71, it's 23 years old, and it's getting a little poor, but to me this was the supreme moment of synergetics, when I realized you're really seeing electromagnetic wave form in the eye. Now, I think this is a very good place to stop for Sunday. It is now almost 3:20. I would like to keep myself fresh. How many? Can you tell me how much time we've done today?
We got
something in worthwhile, do you feel? I would think that I might go a little slow on you now, and I'd like not to do that. So let us break up. I would like you to realize we've got enough tape for 60 hours. I don't think we're going to make the 60 hours. If we did 4 hours today, and I think we had about 60, we're about at 20. And we have just about the same amount of run ahead. I think we may get up to 40. And it is my suspicion that I have learned to say things more compactly. I know that I'm really coming a whole lot of territory today, where I used to go quite detailed following. I'm exploring myself, and now it's so much more familiar that I'm probably compacting the 60 hours into the 40. I feel that way about it. So that I think we're going to have the total experience. If we get the end of the time, I'm quite certain I'm not going to be withholding from you some of the things that I feel are all this important interrelatedness, because I do come into you time again with new kinds of thrusts, and yet you find everything getting back in the same fundamental world. It's really just more and more thrilling.